Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, August 15th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140, and our participant code is 385-698. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, support National Liberty Alliance directly by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab up on the top right-hand corner of our website. Tonight's scripture reading is going to be John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John. The same came for witness, to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory, the glory as the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bare witness of him and cried, saying, This was he of whom I spake. He that cometh after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness have all we received the grace of grace, grace for grace. For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. No man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. That was the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. Okay, tonight, we're going to cover a few things. We're not going to spend too much time. We're going to go pretty quick over to Brent. I see that Brent is here. Brent, you're unmuted. Maybe you can mute yourself until we're ready. Star 6. Anyway, I just want to cover a couple of things we've been talking about a lot in the past. We need to be thinking about these things. We need to get involved in these things, and that is communications during an emergency situation, which we know is coming soon. It is clear that we're going to have a monetary collapse. What exactly that means, we have to question that. Everyone has to answer that to the best they can. I say let's prepare for the worst and hope for the best, because that's the best preparation. Anything less than that is not satisfactory. We do know that a monetary collapse comes with a monetary collapse is hyperinflation. That's the first part of it. And how long hyperinflation, and to what degree, until we have a complete collapse, I have no clue. We're on uncharted waters, and the United States of America is about to enter those uncharted waters. Anybody who's watching the news and paying attention knows it. There's a lot more going on behind the scenes, but the most important thing is what we're talking about here and preparing for that. And that's why we're pushing very hard on the committees of safety to prepare for safety within your community. But the committees of safety have a lot more than just preparing for what's going on in your community. We're going to talk just a little bit about that. But before we go into that, Ham Radios, we had our first meeting on Saturday at 12 noon. We met for about 2 hours, and we had our first meeting concerning ham radios and emergency services. Anybody who would like to listen in to that program, that you can find it up on the COS page. That's nationallibertyalliance.org on the blue line. Go to COS, click on that, come somewhere. I think it's all the way towards the bottom is where we put the ham radio meeting. But it's on that page. We also post information concerning ham radios. We had a couple of flyers up there, and we'll have some more stuff going on up there. This is part of the Committee of Safety's job to get a committee of correspondents within inside every Committee of Safety that really focuses in on communications. Paul Revere was on the Committee of Correspondents who sat on the Committee of Safety. He was a member of the Committee of Safety, a chairman, probably the chairman of the Committee of Correspondents. And we need to understand the importance of the structure, which we're going to talk a little bit about that. Committee of Safety meetings, we're having that on Thursday, and it's really for organizing the Committees of Safety, getting things going, explaining what the Committees of Safety is. We have also those meetings going on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here in this room. The ham radio meetings will be held on, I think it's Wednesday at 8 p.m. Let me double check. Yep, yeah. Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, ham radio preparing for emergency communications. The recording's going to be found at, again, I mentioned before, the COS page. Okay. Committee of Safety meeting, I just mentioned that. Thursday's 9 p.m. Everyone should be involved. We need to build Committees of Safety. Woe is us if we ignore this call. I also want to remind everyone that time is short. Time is extremely short. By the grace of God, we may be given more time, but we have no clue. We do know that we have a mark of September 30th, 2016. That's the day that the rest of the nations have pulled together to work out a solution for themselves and dump the dollar. We need to figure a way to get into those negotiations. We need to get the governors involved. We'd love to write some papers and get them out. We are writing some stuff, but we need some money to do that. So please, anybody that could help, with some extra support, we'd appreciate that. But we got to get some messages out to Congress. We got to get some messages out, particularly to our governors. We need to remind them what the Constitution says about nothing but gold or silver being legal tender. That's a requirement. Every state needs to obey that. That's what this Constitution says. And so no state shall make anything other than gold or silver legal tender. So we need to get back to that. We need to remind them and get connected with the international community working out surviving the dollar. Okay. Right now, to my best of knowledge, they're not participating. But we also need to remind them of their duty to protect the people and to make sure that militias, well-regulated militias, are in place. Again, more requirement upon the governor that we need to remind them of. And we also need to remind them that should they participate in martial law executed by the federal government during these times of trouble, they would be guilty of treason, and it would be eventually we, the people, will try them for treason. So listen, we got to get the word out, and we do need money. We need to file more papers. We're knee-deep in quite a few cases right now. We'll get into more details of those cases over the next couple of weeks. There should be some exciting news on that. Let's see. What else do we have here? Okay. I just want to go through something very quickly here. I just threw some notes together. I'm going to kind of read this. It's one page. It's about the Continental Congress. This is our roots. This is where we come from. This is how we became created. We became the United States of America through the Continental Congress. And there were three calls for the Continental Congress, the first, the second, and the third. And they all existed prior to 1789. 1789, the Constitution was finally adopted, and George Washington became the first president of the United States. And the Continental Congress went to bed, so to speak. They rested. Well, what we need to know and understand is that the Continental Congress could not have come to be without the Committee of Safety. It is the Committee of Safety that prepared this process and formed the First Continental Congress, which was for the safety of the people, to work together colony to colony to protect the people and to do certain things, which we're going to read a little bit about it right now. The Second Continental Congress declared war, and the Third Continental Congress prepared for the running of a government during that war, which again folded its hands in 1789. So let me just read this through. Again, I kind of just threw some things together. Hopefully it'll come through nice and seamless, but we'll see how this goes. The Continental Congress, also known, this is really just the facts. That's all we're interested in, is just the facts. The Continental Congress, also known as the Philadelphia Congress, was a convention of delegates that came together under the Committees of Safety, called together from the 13 colonies. All the colonies had committees of safety. All communities within these colonies had committees of safety. This is how they formed to prepare to send delegates. So the delegates, which were sent from the committees of safety coming together, called together from the 13 colonies, which became the governing body of the United States during the American Revolution. The Congress met from 1774 to 1789 in three incarnations. Number one, first incarnation. The first call for a convention was made over issues of blockades and intolerable acts penalizing the province of Massachusetts, which in 1774 enabled Benjamin Franklin to convince the colonies to form a representative body, the Committees of Safety. Much of that we know today comes from the yearly logbooks printed by the Continental Congress called Resolutions, Acts and Orders of Congress, which gives a day-to-day description of the debates and the issues. On September 5th, 1774, delegates from each of the 13 colonies, except Georgia, which were fighting a Native American uprising and was dependent on the British for military supplies, met in Philadelphia as the First Continental Congress to organize colonial resistance to Parliament, Parliament's coercive acts, which was a series of measures imposed by the British government on the colonies in response to their resistance to the new taxes. The Congress adopted the Continental Association of 1774, which recommended that each colony enforce a boycott of British goods. It was the Committee of Safety that provided an interconnection of the colonies to enforce the boycott in all colonies, and also enforce the non-exportation of American goods to Britain. The second Continental Congress was a convention of delegates from the 13 colonies that started meetings in the summer of 1775 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that soon after warfare declared that the American Revolution War had begun. Although the delegates were divided early on as to whether to break from the crown rule, the Second Continental Congress on July 2, 1776, passed a resolution asserting independence with no oppositional vote recorded. The Declaration of Independence was issued 2 days later, declaring themselves a new nation, the United States of America. It established a Continental Army, giving command to one of its members, George Washington of Virginia. It waged war with Great Britain. Britain made a military treaty with France and funded the war's effort with loans and paper money. Third Continental Congress was the Congress of the Confederation, or the Confederation Congress under Articles of Confederation, formerly referred to as the United States in Congress, assembled, was the governing body of the United States of America that existed from March 1, 1781 to March 4, 1789. And that was the birth, ended with the birth of the United States of America and the Constitution for the United States of America. We, the people, need to follow what our founding fathers did. We need to, but they've already set things up. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We don't have to reinvent the Constitution. We already have one. We don't have to reinvent our government. We already have a great government. We have government structures from the federal down into the state, into the county, the towns, the villages, and so on. We have all the governments we need. The problem is we have tyrants that have seized control of our government. That therein is our problem. And we have a lot of useful idiots that are processing and responding to the orders of these people that have seized control. So our way of saving the nation ultimately begins with knowledge. We have to give people knowledge, knowledge of the Constitution, knowledge of the common law, knowledge of what liberty truly is, and also a little bit of knowledge. We don't need too much, but a little bit of knowledge of how they did it. And we supply and facilitate, shall I say, all of that knowledge, all of that information right here at nationallibertyalliance.org. And we need to take back our courts, and we need to take back the political process. And we do that simply by creating four administrators in each county, administrators for the grand jury and, of course, the trial jury, to orientate them, to bring the courts back under common law, and to require the obedience of all elected officials to be bound, binded down by the chains of the Constitution, as Jefferson had said. Second, we need to take control of the political process. And there's only one way to take control of the political process, and that's by taking control of the committee man. Now, the committee man, when the Committee of Safety back in the early years of America, which created our nation, when that Committee of Safety worked out its process, that was the body politic in action, actually, is what it was. The people within all of the colonies, within all of the communities, working together and sending delegates to talk, to unite in the committees of safety. Exactly what we're trying to build up today is to get the committees of safety operating in every single county and uniting. And our focus and our purpose on the committees of safety, as far as what we really need them to do, is to bring knowledge into the community, knowledge to our local governments, knowledge to our sheriffs, to make them to understand the chain of command during an emergency, to make sure that that sheriff in every county is out there guarding with his life the Constitution for the United States of America, guarding with his life the Bill of Rights, our unalienable rights that are protected by that Bill of Rights. That's his job and that's his duty. And at the end of all of this, it is his job to make sure that we still have that and it's still working and still being executed during this process in time. Justice and mercy needs to be applied during these times. We spoke about a lot of this, and we've got a lot of recordings on this, and our Committee of Safety meetings have spoken about this and laid the plans out, so I'm not going to get too much deeper than that. But after the Continental Congress dispersed, that was the body politic in action. It elected its new government, but they didn't just go away and go home and forget about it. Well, they had government by the consent of the people, and those committees of safety continued to hold their government together through their consent, just as we read about in the Declaration of Independence. We have government by the consent of the people. And so they morphed into the committee men. We, the people, through the committees of safety, through the workings and taking back of our courts to bring justice back into America, to require the obedience of law to all of these people that are elected or appointed or just plain out servants hired to obey the Constitution, to obey the law. The Constitution requires of every judge to obey the law of the land, Article 6. But that extends further than the judges. Everybody elected takes an oath to the Constitution. They are sworn to obey the law of the land. And when they no longer obey the law of the land, they need to be removed from their place. And of course, that's what we will be doing through the administrations within the courts once we gain access and take that power and authority by God's grace. Only the people can save America. But we'll only save it by God's grace, and we'll only save it by the people who step up to do something. If you don't stand up to do something, woe is you. You have failed, and we cannot fail. If we fail, liberty will be lost forever. The light of liberty will be gone. So, but in any event, our plan, of course, is through these committees of safety, we too will morph back into the committeeman. We will take control of the committeeman process. We will get to decide who we're going to put on our ballots, and we're going to require statesmen. We're going to require people who know the Constitution and understand the unalienable rights of the people and understand the common law. And if they don't, they can't come into office. That's what we're going to press upon the people through the committees of safety, to educate them to realize that that's the kind of a statesman that we need. And here at National Liberty Alliance, we will provide the facilities. We will facilitate for that education to our elected officials, and we will then document anyone who comes through our courses and therefore becomes eligible for election. You can't elect people who don't know what the Constitution is about. You can't elect people who don't know what the common law is about. You can't elect people who don't believe in the common law, that believe in statutory law. We can't be electing all of these bar attorneys that bring nothing but stress and pressure and depression upon the American people with their silly codes requiring us to obey their every heed. And every turn you make on all of these codes, they're making money. It's all about money, 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 money. You can't even get into their courts without money. We got to turn all that around. So working as the committeemen, the committees of safety, morphing back into the committeeman process, taking control of the political process and the administrations of the grand jury and the trial jury, taking control of the judiciary process, we indeed then at that point in time will have government by our consent. We will control their behavior to obey the Constitution, or we will remove them from office forthwith with an indictment, or the committeemen can remove them by bringing a recall against them. And so that's how we will control our people. We've lost that control. We do not have the control of those two processes, the judicial and the political. We need to take it back. We don't need to get involved with the politics. We don't need to get involved with the BS. We just need to get involved with the political process. We need to teach people about the political process, not to be confused with politics. Okay. All right, that's pretty much all that I have to say about that. Everybody needs to get into this battle. Time is short. We have no more time, people. We need to be making these committees of safeties everywhere. We need to be preparing and coming together and bringing the power and the authority back to we the people at the grassroots level. And remember, we the people are the militia, you know. Brent Winters, who's going to speak in a few minutes, he's been teaching us about the militia. And we need to understand that we are the militia. The Committee of Safety is the militia. We the people are the militia. We need to, and right now, we need to, if we're going to be called in for service as the militia, it probably at this point will be under the lead of the sheriff, if we can bring him out of his, pit of statutory law, I guess. It's probably a good thing, the pit of statutory law, because they can execute statutory law. They can see a broken statute like that and immediately go forward to arrest people and to bring them in for their code violations and all this other stuff. But certain code violations they're unable to see. They're unable to see when the probably out of fear or something. I don't know. They just don't see it when the judges and the people in the courts and these political these people in political power, they break all these rules and laws, and they're unable to see it. Well, we have to teach it to them. They need to step up, and they need to start doing something about it. And that's up to the Committee of Safety to bring the knowledge of the Constitution, the knowledge of the chain of command, the knowledge of the law of the land to our sheriffs first and foremost, and then our local governments. And that's what we're doing with the Committees of Safety. Okay, before we move on any further, do we have any questions out there, Jen?
Yes, I have two tonight. The first one is, John, last week on the Monday night call, you mentioned to a caller about including a memorandum on jurisdiction with your federal case filings. Could this memorandum be shared and accessible to NLA members on the website for those also filing in the federal courts and seeking to remedy their cases in a court of record?
Yeah, we're going to be doing a couple of cases, which we're not going to talk about at the moment. Everybody's heard about them. We have spoken about them in the past. We're not even going to name them at the moment. But in the next couple of weeks, we'll be hearing a lot of talk about them. And we'll be filing papers into these courtrooms, courts. And the way we're going to battle this case he needs to be appreciated by those who are fighting in the federal courts on how to go forward to fight in these federal courts. And one of the early documents into the court case, there's about three or four documents we're going to file first, which should give us a shoo-in and put a lot of stress and pressure on them. They'll be on the defensive, and we definitely will be on the offensive. The pressure of the people, the pressure of the press, hopefully, we'll be getting some press support on this, mostly local press. But the pressure on these people, by God's mercy and God's will bring us into this court. Once we get our feet into the court and we pry that door open and we get in a little bit, then we're going to start filing papers. And one of the papers we will be filing is the one on jurisdiction, which is one of the first memorandums I file or would be filing with any complaint if we were filing a complaint. Well, we really don't file complaints. We file actions at law. So any action at law we file, we would file that. Any kind of a court case, for instance, in some court, if you were accused of something and you came in as a defendant, you have to understand you're coming into an administrative court. Doesn't matter what court you're coming into. If it's called a criminal court particularly, that's an administrative court. That's statutory court. It has nothing to do with the law of the land. You have to overtake that. Hopefully you'll be able to see how to do that in a lot of what we're doing. We also have another case we might be sharing which will show that kind of a mechanism, but I don't know. But particularly these other cases, a lot of these memorandums that we'll write, that being, I think, one of the most important things. You know, the law requires, so says the Supreme Court, the law requires that the jurisdiction on any administrative court must be put on the top of their papers. They must state what jurisdiction they're in. They never do. They never do. So what we will be doing is stating the jurisdiction on the top of every paper. We'll be putting jurisdiction, and then right next to that, we will put court of record. That goes according to the rules of common law, or under the rules of the common law. And we'll put footnotes in there, and every paper will be filed. And one of the things we'll be telling all the people within those courts to make sure that they put upon the top of their paper what jurisdiction they think they're in. And we'll let them know, if you put no jurisdiction up there, then we know for sure we're not an administrative court because you by law are required to do so. And since you haven't done so, you agree with us. So we're going to put that kind of language in there. You have to make sure you're in a court of record. You have to make sure. Now, there is no, I've looked in the Constitution, and I feel very confident at this point to make this statement. I don't see anywhere where Congress has given any authority and we're talking about on the federal level, to create any courts other than the Article III court subservient to the one Supreme Court, okay? I see no place else. People talk about the Article V court or something. It makes no sense. I can't find it. I have no idea what they're talking about. And I see no authority other than an Article III court, which is to operate under the law of the land under Article 6. There's no getting away from it. And so even though they've created administrative courts, and even though the United States Supreme Court has mentioned and acknowledged that some of these administrative courts exist, they do make the point of separation between the two, okay? But their acknowledgement seems to be focusing in, if I understand them correctly, their acknowledgement seems to be focusing in on the District of Columbia. And, of course, they have said that everything is a District of Columbia at this point. You know, I mean, all of the states are in the District of Columbia. You know, you go read Article 20, I mean, USC 26, you know, it talks about all that stuff in there. But also in USC 26, it says that it's not to be taken as law. So that's very interesting. That's something to bring up if you're in a court that pushes heavily on the US 26, like the IRS cases. So, and they work with seizing property under in rem, another, you know, unconstitutional process of the land. So Anyway, hopefully I answered the question. We will be sharing it. It'll be coming soon. As soon as we straighten up our paperwork up online, which hopefully will be in the next week or so, and we start filing these papers, it'll end up there. So I'd say in a couple of weeks it should be up there. Second question. Good.
Yes, under the police power, the government can pass any law to protect the morals, health, safety, peace, and general welfare of society. According to Bouvier's Law Dictionary, the police power is the application of the personal right or principle of self-preservation of the body politic. Since the common law is unwritten, but the police powers must be written statutes, please explain the relationship of the police power to the common law.
Well, look, at the police power, they can have whatever they want, providing they don't violate my unalienable right. I have a right to drive. Don't tell me I need a driver's license, although we have to comply at this point in time because we need to decide where we're going to make our battles. But nevertheless, as long as their police power laws or statutes have no injury to my unalienable rights, I'm good with them. But look at, I don't even know if police departments are really, city, town, village police departments are really very constitutional. Clearly they're not, in the sense they're code violation officers is what they are. And most of these codes, if not all of them, violate our unalienable rights. So therefore they're unlawful. Now you could have a private community where you live in. I know, for instance, out in Connecticut here, along the water, hold on a second. Okay, along the Long Island Sound there. Okay, very rich communities, and they have these checkpoints. You have to go past an officer sitting in his little box and stuff, and they have these those gates that go up and down like through a toll booth. It's set up like a toll booth to get into the community. When you pull up there, they want to know where you're going, and they want to know your name. They write down your license plate. Well, the community, actually, it's a private community, so to speak, and they've created that system. And they've also created their own little police force in there. That's all legal, and to do certain things if all the people in the community agree to it. You can't get that done in a town or a city or a village. You can't get all the people to agree to these statutes. They're not going to. I know I wouldn't. So if everyone in the community wants to agree to these statutes, and when I say that community, I mean like a village, which is not a private, place like these little communities I talked about. But you can't take a city or a town. If there's one person in it that disagrees, then that's it. It's over. And you know you're going to have a lot of people that disagree. So look, at the only really lawful officer of the law is the sheriff. And the sheriff is the one to defend the Constitution. And to break the law, ultimately, if you do a criminal act, you've injured someone, and that person that's injured would sign a complaint, and therein is the law. You know, you have to now pay restitution if you're found guilty of injuring that individual. And whatever the court says, and that's it. That's the way the law is. You know, you've also got to understand, look, there's a lot of things in Bouvier's and there's a lot of things in Black's law, and you got to understand that there's a lot of courts, and they talk about the language and the meanings of words and the different things in all those different courts. The court we're interested in is the court that we have that is under the law of the land, and that's the only court we're interested in. We're not interested in administrative courts. We're not interested in anything that deals with police powers. We don't need that. We have the militia if there's a really serious problem, and we have the sheriff, and we also have posse comitatus if there's sort of an in-between of the two, which could be pulled together by the sheriff in order to deal with some kind of a major situation. So we the people can handle that, and it's that simple. So I don't know if I answered that completely. Was there any other part I didn't answer there?
No, I think that covers it.
Okay.
Should be all set.
All right, that's the last question? All right.
Yes, it is.
Gerard, you got any? Thank you, Jim. Does anybody else out there on the leadership level have anything they want to share, anything, an announcement or anything? I do want to say that we want to call all hams to the Wednesday night 8 p.m. meeting for communications. And anybody else interested in becoming a ham, anybody interested in getting a ham license, or anybody interested just in learning as much as they can, you can go to that meeting. you know, out of that meeting, Terry and Bob, I need to get a frequency for Channel 7. I need it this week. I need it Wednesday, let's say. Give you till Wednesday. So Thursday morning, you guys need to have one. So please. So is there anybody else out there, do you know, Jan, that wants to announce anything? Or
no,
any chair, anybody?
Didn't have any other questions or comments from anybody.
Okay. Gerard, you got anything to add before we move over to Brent? You got to hit star six. Unmute your mic there if you want to talk. Okay, maybe he's not near his mic. Okay. All right, we're going to move over to Brent Winters. Brent Winters, the author of Excellent in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. You have to hit star six to unmute yourself, Brent.
I just unmuted him.
Okay.
Somebody unmuted me, apparently.
Yep, there you go. You got it.
Appreciate it. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to say a couple of things here. Somebody emailed me and said this. I'm reading the email. This is from last Monday night's call. He said, I was on the call last Monday night. I'm not sure what you said at one point. I'm paraphrasing. The second caller from Indiana, a fellow named Brian, asked a question about the New World Order and quoted G. Edward Griffin. And in your response, you sounded like you said, and I'm going to read what he thought I said. He's got it in quotes. G. Edward Griffin has tried to, and rightly done so, and I appreciate it. He's tried to save the elect. Tried to save the elect. Apparently that's what he heard. I didn't go back and listen to what I said and try to decipher it. I wish I'd had time to do that. But to make it abundantly clear, G. Edward Griffin, as far as I know, has never said that he wanted to save the elect. Now, God says he wants to save the elect, and he promises to do so. Whoever they are, he doesn't tell us. But G. Edward Griffin, even if he'd have said it, he doesn't have the power to do that. If somebody wants to go back and listen, I may have time this week to go back and listen to the recording and see what it is I said. But I do like to hear from folk, and I appreciate this fellow sending me an email, and maybe I can find out what it is exactly I said before. But the only remedy to lawlessness, the lawlessness we see, is law. We need to keep that at the forefront of our brains and never lose sight of it. And, of course, then that begs the next question, what is true law? And our Declaration of 76, in my studied opinion, has rightly stated what true law is. It's the only true law. There is no other law. The laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things in creation. And the laws of nature is God, written in our Bibles. That is the meaning of the phrase, the laws of nature and the laws of nature is God. From our Declaration of 76, William Blackstone affirms that and expounds it a little bit in Volume 1. Go there and find it if you're more interested and want to read more about it. That is the foundation of our law. That's, of course, our organic law by Declaration of Congress. Our Declaration of 76 is one of those four documents that they claim are foundational, and I think, again, they have rightly claimed are foundational to our understanding. Our Declaration of 76 is a product of our Christian past. Our Christian past, and the Word of God is axiomatic, fundamental to Christianity. Without it, we have nothing. There's no priesthood that has a lock on telling us what it says either, by the way, or has a lock on the truth. It is the Bible and the Bible alone that is the ultimate and final rule, even for the laws of nature. The laws of nature. The Bible's clear and speaks unambiguously to our minds on any subject. Then that settles the matter, and all of the revelations from God in either of those two volumes, the laws of nature, the laws of nature's God, all other revelations of God must conform to that clear, unambiguous statement. It is the habit of mankind to find those statements that are ambiguous to his own mind, whether in nature or in the Bible, and then focus all attention on that and say we cannot know. That's foolishness. And even in our writings of legal significance, all of them, including our Constitution and its statutes, men have always, for centuries, and we still do, and it has served us well. We interpret the ambiguous, the unclear, the obscure passage, obscure to any degree, according to our clear understanding of the unambiguous passage. We do that today, and we should continue to do it with writings of legal significance, regardless of how ancient. I want to direct people, if I forget, if I don't do it now, direct them to the website, www.commonlawyer.com. That's commonlawyer.com. I think there's 40 or 50 hours on the media page of me talking. 7 to 8.5 minute clips, most of them pretty short, on a lot of subjects. You can see the titles there if you go to the media page at commonlawyer.com and click on it. It's like sliced bread. You can pull out the one you want and listen to it. If it is something that interests you, you can keep listening, or you can go to another one, or you can put it down whenever it pleases you. I'm a fellow that has for decades sat pretty much by myself, sequestered because of the kind of business I've been in over the years by myself. When I was raising livestock, I was by myself, and later I was in the mining business out west in Arizona and Nevada, and I spent days and weeks and months and years by myself, and had my books with me, and I did a lot of reading and studying, and of course, then also in the last 10 years, I've been pretty much by myself doing the same thing. I've been able, through the kindness of people like John and company, I've been able to get out and talk a little bit about what I find when I study, contemplate, and try to dig things out. I pass along. I don't want to be the use of keeping it to myself. So that's what we're doing this evening. We're talking about the militia of the several states. Got to thinking this week, I had heard someone say that the extreme left, and the left is always extreme, and politics, by the way, always drives men to two extremes, two poles. Inevitably, that's what will happen. That is what has happened here. But the extreme left has said that now it's time to repeal or do away with, somehow, the Second Amendment. Well, I've got news for them, and I want to pass along this, and I want it to go viral, and I want everybody to be talking about it. I did learn in politics. I was in politics for a while. I learned that it's more important to get people talking than it is to get them talking about the right thing. Just get them talking about it. Well, I hope you're talking the right thing when you talk about this, but what I want to say in response to these folks that say it's time to get rid of the Second Amendment, getting rid of the Second Amendment will not do away with the militia of the several states. First, the Second Amendment grants no rights. The Second Amendment delegates no rights, no permission. It simply says that the government is supposed to help secure these rights. Now, if government doesn't do that, it's up to, if the federal government doesn't do it, it's up to the state governments to do it, the local governments, the county level, the sheriffs, the governors of the states, the attorney generals, the local states, attorney in each county. It's up to them, following the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. It's up to them. They are to stand between a tyrannical government and the individual. That's their job. That's the job of every person in public office, whether it be the president of the United States. It's his job, it has always been his job, to stand between the states and the people of the states and any tyrant who would try to conquer our country. We've had that happen in the past. That's his job. It's the governor's job to stand between such foreign tyrants and such domestic tyrants as presidents. And it's the state attorney general's job to do the same thing. And it's the local county sheriff's job to do the same thing, to stand against state attorney generals and governors and presidents and officers, swarms of officers that want to stop people from from obeying their rights. Why are individual rights, there are no other kind of right, individual, there are no group rights. Why are individual rights so important? The reason is this, repeating what I've said before, but it bears repeating. Individual rights are those duties. Rights are duties. That's the meaning of the old Germanic Anglo-Saxon word, right. They have another word for law. They have another word that means law in a larger sense, but a right. A right, as they used to say, is a duty. And they are duties. The rights, our fundamental rights, are those duties that God himself, as our Declaration of 76 points out, God himself bestows direct upon the individual without any intermediary. No government, no priesthood, no church, no nothing, no nobody, no institution. God gives it direct to the individual, and God has given rights direct to the individual by the virtue of him having created them. It is his jurisdiction, his right to do so, and he has. And when God gives a right to a man or a woman, woe be to anyone who would try to get in the way of that man or that woman's use of that rights for God's purposes and glory. That's what rights are for, by the way. You have right, absolute jurisdiction over your tongue. To speak or not to speak, that's the Fifth Amendment. The right to remain silent in the First Amendment. The right to speak. God has given you that jurisdiction. He didn't give it to anybody else. And by the way, no one has the power to take it away from you. Oh, they can threaten you. And you may cave in, but no. If you don't want to talk, you don't have to. I mean, even if people kill you, you still don't have to. And there have been plenty of people in the history of the world that have chosen death instead of talking. And by the same token, you can speak as an example of a fundamental right. And you better know when God would have you speak and when he would have you remain silent. That's why both of those are there, so that government, both of those, the First and the Fifth Amendment, so that government will be bound to protect your exercise of your discernment and individual duty before God. And by the way, nobody else can do that for you. No one can do that for you. No one can exercise your Second Amendment right, self-preservation. God gave it to you. No one else can do it for you. They may try, but in the final analysis, if everybody fails, it's your business. Men are given that right to protect that right, that duty to protect themselves. How can a man care for himself and his family if he's dead or maimed? That's the whole point. God has given men duties and jurisdictions, and with that comes the duty to defend that jurisdiction. Let me bring up one other thing here. The subject a while ago was mentioned about the police powers, and Bouvier was quoted. And Bouvier, of course, he had substantially right about that, but what Bouvier did not say, well, I don't know, I didn't read it. The part he quoted did not say that the government of the United States, the general government, sitting in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia, has absolutely no police powers within the boundaries of the 50 states and or any of them. And it was said rightly a while ago, the police powers are the power to ensure and bring about and control and regulate the health, education, and welfare of the people of a particular state. And within the boundaries of any particular state, that state legislature, with any powers given to the governor and the courts, the government there has absolute police power within the boundaries of the states. The federal government has absolute police powers extending to the limits of the jurisdiction of the District of Columbia, military, forts, arsenals, and bases, and, of course, on the high seas. And among military servicemen, on the field of battle, of course. But to add that all up, the federal government, the general government, as our forebears used to call it, sitting in Washington, D.C., has police powers, but these police powers, health, education, and welfare, are extremely limited, curtailed, and defined. The police powers of the states are plenary within the boundaries of the states. That's the distinction the police powers under our constitutional arrangement, the Constitution of the United States, are divided and separated. The federal government attempts and is attempting and has attempted by every stretch, an attenuated stretch of the imagination, to extend the police powers into the states through the Admiralty Clause, claiming jurisdiction over navigable waters, and then waters that may be made navigable, and then waters that flow into waters that may be made navigable. Then takes in, of course, the whole watershed of a particular river, creek, or rivulet, and by that, and did the same thing before our independence, and by that stretch, attempts to exert police powers, health, education, and welfare throughout the United States. That's unconstitutional. Now, one book has been written on the subject that has been exhaustive and, in my opinion, conclusive. There may be different ways to say it, but he said it about as clearly and exhaustively as it could be said. His name was Tom Cooley. Tom Cooley. C-O-O-L-E-Y, I believe. It might be C-O-O-L-Y, but I believe there's an E in there. And the name of the book is The Police Powers. And you can, it's in the title. Funny thing, I remember the author more often than I remember the titles. The author and the subject matter. But his whole subject matter it was written, I believe, 1868. I believe his whole idea was to lay out in no uncertain terms the limits of the federal government in the states respecting police powers, health, education, and welfare. And to show that the federal government has none of those powers within the states, isn't it amazing that the federal government seeks to control all education of all things? Obviously, one of the three subject matters of the police powers, but attempts to control all of it in all states. And states are stupid enough. When I say stupid, I use the word in its etymological sense. Thick, slow, and dumb to understand, apparently, and take money and give up. The legislatures of the state give up that police power called the power over education. What an incredible power. To sodomiting, child-molesting thugs that have somehow gotten hold of the levers of power in a faraway place of madness called Washington, D.C. If you've not been there, I suggest you stay home. It's a place of madness. You can go to Washington, D.C. and park along the street somewhere, park in somebody's driveway that you may know. And when you get home, you'll have a parking ticket waiting for you for $50, $100, $150. Just because they found your car there out of state, they decide to see if they can milk you for some money. That's the tip of the iceberg about Washington, D.C. One of only two cities in the United States chartered by the federal government. The other one, Shawneetown, Illinois, both of them miserable failures as cities. No example for the rest of the country, that's for sure. The militia of the several states. Somebody sent me an article. Listener, appreciate it. And the name of the article is 27 Words. And he asked me, are these guys right? Well, both of them were law professors. One of them was named Rosen. Rosen, R-O-S-E-N. The other one's named Bracco, R-A-K-O-V-E. Both of them professors. Before I get into just going through this quickly, they did say some good things. It's important to understand what a law professor is. Most people put them on a pedestal, think that there's something to them. A law professor is somebody who has learned to please from a very young age. He goes to law school with straight A's under his belt all through high school and college. He makes straight A's in law school. That means he spits back to professors everything that they like to hear and they have learned at heart. And then they get on law review. And then when they get out, they go to clerk for a federal judge. This is the career track of a law professor. Now stay with me. Then they clerk for a federal judge, whether a district court judge, an appellate judge, or a Supreme Court judge. And then after that, after clerking for a federal judge, learning the inside system, then generally they get a big offer to work for a very large law firm as a partner immediately. As a partner immediately, that means $300,000 a year often. A lot of money. Because they think this guy's got an end with the federal courts. And then they work at that for anywhere from 5 to 10 years, usually 7 or 8. It's this way almost every time. That's the career track. And then the next step is to apply for a professorship at a major law school, if you can get it, but they don't all get that. But they do get professorships at law school and get paid a pretty penny, a couple hundred thousand a year probably, to relax and not fight it anymore and just teach and make life hard for law students. Now these law professors are people that are inside trackers. They do not deviate from what is accepted in the profession and in the courts and in that means ultimately popular political opinion. So when you read what a law professor says, it's important to keep that in mind. You might learn something. They say some nice things here, but I can tell that their spirit is skewed a little. They say, for example, at the time of the American Revolutionary War, militias were groups of able-bodied men who protected their towns, colonies, and eventually states. Well, that's true. When the Constitution was drafted, these men continued, the militia was a state-based institution. That's true also. States were responsible for organizing this. That's true also. And our Constitution of the United States, the four militia clauses, say it just that way. Then they addressed the question, what is well regulated? And then if you remember what I'd said about it over the last number of weeks, I hope you recognize what they're saying here. They say one of the biggest challenges in interpreting a centuries-old document is that the meanings of the words change or diverge. That's true also. We have to know what the words meant at that time. Well-regulated, I'm quoting, well-regulated in the 18th century tended to be something like well-organized. Well, no, that's not right. Well-armed, that's right. Well-disciplined, that means you're a good marksman and you're safe. You know, those two are right. Well organized? No, that's not right. But he says this. It didn't mean regulation in the sense that we use now about a regulatory state. It's not like the regulatory state. Well, he's right about that. Listen to what he says, though, when he ends, and he hits the nail on the head here. He says this. It means the militia was in an effective shape to fight. Well regulated, says this man, means that the militia was in an effective shape to fight. Well, that's pretty much hitting the nail on the head. It means ever ready, the Minutemen that were ready at a moment's notice, kept their firearm loaded by the door, along with ammunition and powder horn, so they could grab it as they went out the door. That's a man that's keeping things well regulated. Understand, well regulated did not mean something that came down from the top. And he makes this point. He alludes to it. Although he doesn't say that clearly, well-regulated means that every man knows his duty, and he does it. And by the way, there never is regulation in a military organization or a paramilitary organization unless every man just flat does his duty. That's why boys go to boot camp, so that they won't have to be regulated. They become self-regulated. They learn habits that they never get rid of, and they follow them. Well, then they talk about the security of expanding country. Then they said this, what does a free state mean? They beat around the bush a lot, and they don't say anything about it, really. They do say that the Second Amendment is founded substantially upon the amendment of Section 13 of the Virginia Declaration of Rights of 1777. And it helps inform our Second Amendment. Because Madison, being from Virginia, having drafted our Second Amendment, grew from this, and that Virginia Declaration of Rights, Section 13, says this, a well-regulated militia, or composed of the body of the people, trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. Standing armies in time of peace, it continues, should be avoided as dangerous to liberty, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. They didn't like standing armies. And that's why the militia, the Second Amendment, and the other four militia clauses are part of our Constitution. Because the drafters and the ratifiers of our Constitution didn't like standing armies. They knew that standing armies were dangerous to our freedom. I talked to a fella today who knew two young fellas that had joined the military, and both of them, have been asked by their superiors if they would be willing to fire upon American citizens who would not turn over their arms. It's getting pandemic in our military forces. Our military forces are expected to turn on the people. Who are the people? The people. I remind you again, it bears repeating, the phrase "the people" is lifted by our forebears, our first fathers, the Puritans. Winston Churchill called them the most biblical race of men that ever lived. He was probably pretty close. They kept the FERD, the militia. And the people, if you're familiar with that phrase, and if you go to the Old Testament and look it up in every case, you will discover that always the people refers to an armed group of men. And in most all cases, it is used to refer to the militia of the 12 separate tribes of Israel. The militia of the 12 separate tribes of Israel. And the book of Numbers is written, the fourth book of our Bible, to describe that martial law jurisdiction, along with the priesthood. The priesthood was a martial law jurisdiction, as also the militia of the 12 separate tribes. And the details are astounding. And to contemplate them over the years, or just contemplate them at all, I've been contemplating them for years. It is astounding, the wisdom of those statutes. And the more you follow out what would happen if they were followed, just in your mind, like you're playing checkers, it's astounding what you see. We have a law like that. Only Israel of old has had a law respecting a nation's militia. Like ours like theirs, I should say, but the people is the militia. And we, the people of the United States, means the FERD in old Anglo-Saxon law. The FERD, and the people means the militia, that later word that came to us through the Normans. It's a Latin-rooted word from the Romanization of England a little bit. When we think about rights, say these writers, we think of them as regulations and exemptions. But back at the birth of our nation, they had a different quality. Well, I've mentioned that a while ago. He didn't say any more than that. He just says they were more moralistic. Well, what's he saying? He's saying, well, in order to really explain this, I'd have to talk about God and our response back to God called religion. And I'm not going to do that because I might lose my job. That's really what he's saying. I'll be looked down upon by my colleagues. But he did allude to it, and that's good that he did. But remember, rights are duties to the giver of those rights. They are duties. Right is a jurisdiction. It is authority to do your duty. And our forebears recognized that government has no jurisdiction, no right, to interfere with a man's exclusive jurisdiction given to him by God to do his duty. That's why the Second Amendment says that the right, the duty, that's what it is, to keep and bear, to carry a loaded firearm, shall not be infringed. Why? And by the way, it doesn't say government. Government could be the infringer, but anybody else could be an infringer too, and often are. Some power, some powerful party. No one has the right to get between you and your Creator and the duties he has given you to fulfill. That's the point of the Second Amendment and the entire Bill of Rights. Remember, our Constitution is a brief of common law government. And if our common law, the laws of nature, that first volume of God's revelation of his will to man, that first volume, puts legs to the laws of nature of God written in the Bible, makes it practical, talks to us where the rubber meets the road. That's why the laws of nature, our common law, is so important. almost sounded like I said law, like John says it, with an R on the end. I've been listening to him, and I think I'm picking up that habit. I hear people back in his neck of the woods do that sometimes. These natural rights, they go on to say, such as the right to religious expression, are analogous in some ways to the tenets of our Second Amendment. And then he talks about the term, the people, the most basic catch-all, he says, of all. And he goes on to talk about, and I'd said that, District of Columbia versus Heller. District of Columbia versus Heller, U.S. Supreme Court, the year 2008. Monumental. Landmark. Oddly. Curiously. Nothing much was said about it. Why? Because the powers that be, the evil empire, want to keep it quiet. Let me quote it. Heller, U.S. Supreme Court, 2008, says, I'm quoting, the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a firearm unconnected with service in a militia. Unconnected with service in a militia. What does that mean? That means this. That means that you have the right to have a gun. Why? Because you are the militia. Service in the militia is not in view. What is in view, the Second Amendment, the men that put that in place, is not service in the militia. What is in view is the people, the militia. In fact, the governor of the state, or your state, or the president of the United States has no jurisdiction over the militia until he has called them, summoned them individually, and they are mustered. Summoned and mustered. That's the law. I'm quoting Justice Story of the U.S. Supreme Court on that. So it's unconnected in that way with service in the militia. And to use that arm for traditionally lawful purposes, such as self-defense in the home, is part of what that's all about, says the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court continues, I'm quoting, an amendment's prefatory clause announces a purpose. Oh, I misquoted. I said an amendment. He said, the Supreme Court said the amendments. He's talking about the Second Amendment. The amendment's prefatory clause, some would say prefatory, I like to say prefatory, announces a purpose. And the prefatory clause, of course, is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. They say that announces a purpose, but it does not limit, the court continues, or expand the scope of the second part. The operative clause, now they're talking fundamental hermeneutics of interpretation of documents of legal significance. This kind of language, what they're saying here is what the courts say about statutes and all sorts of deeds and documents, nothing new. The prefatory clause announces a purpose, but it does not limit or expand the scope of the second part, the operative clause. The operative clause, text, and history demonstrate that it connotes an individual right to keep and bear arms. That's the Supreme Court Heller, by the way. And it would be a worthwhile assignment if the listeners would go to Justia and find that case, type in Heller, I'm sorry, D.C. v. Heller, and the year 2008, pull it up and listen to the court and the oral argument. It's fun to listen to the oral argument in that case and their announcement of their decision. And then after that was the McDonald case, City of McDonald versus Chicago, decided 2 years later. I was in the Seventh Circuit arguing a case after the Heller decision, not more than a year, I forget exactly, about, well, less than a year probably. And a lawyer that argued just before it was my turn for the Seventh Federal Circuit, it was a drug case, I believe, some fellow got caught with drugs and they tried to take his gun away from him. And the lawyer said, in light of the Heller decision, the government doesn't have the jurisdiction to take gun away from my client, even if he was found with cocaine in his car. He has a right to self-protection. Well, the court didn't buck much when the lawyer said that. I don't know what that case is about. I was too much concentrated on what I was going to say next. But that case needs to be brought up and argued in court more and more and more, along with McDonald versus City of Chicago, the companion case. Heller, we're back to that federal jurisdiction. The Heller case of 2008 applied the Second Amendment to the individual rights of residents in those places where the federal government has the police powers, namely, in this case, the District of Columbia. D.C. versus McDonald versus City of Chicago, 2010, 2 years later, took the Heller decision and said, yeah, that's true. The feds have that kind of police power, and they have to enforce the Second Amendment in the District of Columbia. But then they went on to say, but in the states, they have the police power there, and no government has the right to infringe on the right to keep and bear arms in the City of Chicago or throughout any of the several states and the juridical entities thereof, such as cities and counties. And the court went on to say, the Federal Circuit, Seventh Circuit, Judge Posner, by the way, the judge that said that it's a waste of time for law students to study the Constitution recently, but he said in that case, he said, Illinois State Legislature, you've got 180 days to get in place legislation protecting the individual right to carry a pistol. Get with the program. In light of Heller versus D.C., we're not going to remake those arguments. You've got 180 days, State Legislature of Illinois, and if you don't do it, we're going to do it for you from the bench. That's strong language. And, of course, shows the unpredictable nature of men like him. But I'm glad he said that. Course. And by the way, those two cases were planned from the very beginning. They worked them into court. They set the whole thing up from start to finish. Both of those cases were part of a scheme to get those cases before the courts and get the Second Amendment established as an individual right. Well, I'll give you some quotes here, and then that'll be enough for this evening, maybe. Daniel Webster, indeed, nothing will ruin the country, says Dan Webster, if the people themselves undertake its safety. Nothing will ruin the country if the people, there's that phrase again, the people, that's the militia, themselves undertake its safety. And then he continues, and nothing can save it if they leave that safety in the hands of any but their own. So when you hear people say, the government will keep you safe, Dan Webster, and he was a student of history, course, Dan Webster said it won't happen that way. The only way to have freedom and safety at the same time is by the militia of the several states and the four militia clauses of our Constitution, which are being, of course, ignored. Militia is evidence of the people, the people's intent. Evidence of the Second Amendment common law meaning is overwhelming. The following is a sampling, I'm going to read them to you, of our founders reflecting the people's view. The people's view. That's the people of the United States. That's the militia. On the right, to keep and carry a loaded gun. Here's Richard Henry Lee from the state of Virginia. Cousin to Robert E. Lee, of course, lived before him. Cousin to Harry Lighthorse Lee, Robert E. Lee's father and veteran of the Revolution. Richard said this, a militia is, in fact, the people themselves. Well, there's what we were saying, of course. Excuse me, he got that from the Puritan forebears. The militia is, in fact, the people themselves and includes, include, because militia, he's speaking of it as a singular, all men, or as a plural, all men capable of bearing arms. The people include all men capable of bearing arms. To preserve liberty, it is essential, he says, that the whole body of the people always possess arms. That's from Letters from the Federal Farmer in the year 1788. Here's George Mason, one of our founding forebears. He says this, I ask, sir, what is the militia? Rhetorically. It is the whole people, says Mason. There we're back to the people. To disarm the people, he says, is the best and most effectual way to enslave them. He said that on the floor of Virginia State House at the ratification convention of our Constitution, the year 1788. Here's good old Sam Adams. Sam said, "The Constitution shall never be construed to prevent the people of the United States, who are peaceful citizens, from keeping their own arms. Never shall it be construed to prevent the people from keeping the people." See, there it is again. That's the militia. That's a quote from the year 1788. On the floor of the House, the Massachusetts ratification of the Constitution Convention. Here's Noah Webster. Noah Webster, Mr. Dictionary himself. "The supreme power in America," said Noah, "cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword." Why? Because in America, the whole body of the people are armed and constitute a force superior to any band of regular troops. Are you noticing their use of the word "the people"? And it isn't like they try to explain it. They just use it that way. But when you look at it, you see that's the way they understood it. The people are the militia. And indeed, again, they got that from their forebears. Tom Jefferson, he had a way of being pert about it. He said this: "No free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms." Proposed Virginia Constitution Convention, 1776. Here's Tom again. "Laws that forbid the carrying of arms disarm only those who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. Such laws make things worse for the assaulted and better for the assailants. They serve rather to encourage than to prevent homicides, for an unarmed man may be attacked with greater confidence than an armed man." Now, Tom said that, but he who never quotes is never quoted. And Tom was quoting an 18th century criminologist, and by the way, he was pretty smart, a Frenchman by the name, well, maybe he was an Italian. Somehow I had it in my head he was a Frenchman. But his name was Cesare Beccaria. And the name of the book is On Crimes and Punishments. And he had studied the history of criminal behavior, and this is his conclusion. He says that gun control, effectually, encourages crime. John Adams said this: "Arms in the hands of individual citizens may be used at the individual discretion in private self-defense." That was in a writing called A Defense of the U.S. Constitution and the Government of the United States. James Madison, called the framer of our Constitution, said this: "The Constitution preserves the advantage of being armed, which Americans possess over," here it is again, "the people of almost every other nation, where the governments are afraid to trust the people with arms." Federalist, that's from Federalist, number 46. This is Tom Paine. "Arms discourage and keep the invader and the plunderer in awe, and preserve order in the world as well as property. Horrid mischief would ensue were the law-abiding deprived of the use of arms." And I'll end with Ben Franklin. "They that give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." He said that long before the Revolution, the year 1759. To sum up, our Fourth Amendment, our Fourth Militia Clause, better known as the Second Amendment, puts the decision to deny a rogue president and police forces with each American, each militiaman, and each militia of the several states, from the state governor to the militia officers to each individual militiaman. Thanks, John. That's enough for this evening, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and say what I've learned.
Okay, thanks a lot, Brent. We'll open up for a few questions for Brent. Anybody has any questions? Well, let me turn on to Q&A. Right, if anybody has any questions or comments for Brent, star 6 to get into the queue. I think they'll ask you to hit 1 after that. Star 6. Okay, our first person is Don from Michigan. Go right ahead, Don.
Hey, Brent. What a great talk. I was very intrigued all the way through. And during a couple of different places, you said some things that I wanted to share what I had heard about them and I just want to get your comment about it. The first one was way back when Obama first got in office and they started talking about the Second Amendment was for this and what was for that, I began to do some research, realizing that, you know, back when the Constitution was written and signed, they spoke in Old English, and many words had many different meanings than what they do today. It was almost entirely a different language at times. And so I went back into the Old English and did some research and looked up the word regulated. And what I found was that in the Old English, if you were well regulated, that meant that you knew how to disassemble and assemble a weapon, clean it, shoot it, become proficient at it, be able to hit a target, be able to take care of it, load it, and so forth. You knew your way around that weapon like the back of your hand. And then when I found that, it made sense to me that in order for you to be well regulated, you have to own a firearm in the first place, or you can't be regulated with it. So I wanted to get your comment on that, and then just real quick, another thing to add to it. It's short. I think there's a decision in the Supreme Court that is as significant as the Heller decision, and it really gets my blood boiling when they talk about banning this type of firearm or that type of firearm. In fact, I laugh thinking back to the lady in California, the senator out there that trying to get rid of all the guns, I can't remember her name right off, but she said, you know, what do you want, a bazooka? And actually, there's a decision, Miller versus U.S., 1939, where the court said that the Second Amendment protects all those arms which are typical and common in military use. And I think that decision is as big or just as big or bigger than the Heller decision. And every time somebody wants to talk about banning firearms, I'm like, Miller versus U.S. says you can't ban any of them if they're used in the Army. So if you could just comment for me on those two things, I'd be incredibly interested in hearing what you had to say.
Well, thanks. Appreciate it. And I think I would agree substantially with the way you presented it. The Miller case had two questions presented that bear upon the nice discussion. What really, at the bottom line, it was all about, if I remember right, was a Tommy gun. And the feds were saying, we have power over interstate commerce to regulate it. There's that word again, regulates, in the Constitution. You know, interstate commerce is to be kept regular. And the case was about whether or not the feds could ban people from taking Tommy guns across Thompson's, the old Thompson machine gun, 45 caliber automatic weapon, take them across state lines. And the Supreme Court made some comments about the Second Amendment during that case that were instructive. But to get back to this, unregulated, oh, you did an excellent job of explaining that. I appreciate that. I was a gunner when I was in the service, and we were required to tear down a 60 caliber machine gun and put it back together blindfolded. We worked in the armory, and that's what we were supposed to do aboard the ship. I was in the Navy, and that's what we were supposed to be able to do in order to get signed off. And that's called well-regulated. A well-regulated man could do that. And the Miller decision talks about regular, but it's about interstate commerce. But that word regular is in the interstate commerce clause, or it affects the interstate commerce clause. And by analogy, regular meant always ready, good to go, and watch this word, free-flowing. I used to watch old Rumpole of the Old Bailey Criminal Court. It was a television program from back in the 70s and 80s about this criminal defense lawyer named Rumpole, and you can still watch them. They're all on YouTube, I think, every episode. Really good if you like law movies and common law and lawyer movies and things and juries. But he said to his wife one time, he called her she who must be obeyed. He said, the claret keeps me regular. The claret. The kind of wine he drank kept him regular. And like they used to tell the fellows in Vietnam, make sure your bowel stays open. Your bowel. Because if your bowel doesn't stay open while you're here, there's all sorts of crazy little critters and bugs and sicknesses that can get in there and grow and cause you all sorts of problems in your digestive tract that could stay with you for many years. In other words, you got to stay regular. What does regular mean? It means free-flowing, like commerce across state lines. It means free-flowing. There are all sorts of analogies we can use, but a militiaman that's regular means that he's free, he's ready to go. He's good to go at a moment's notice, like the Minutemen that were at Concord and Lexington. They kept their rifle, their shot, their powder, hanging right by the door so they could grab it as they ran out. And then when they were out, they carried it with them in case they were called. They wouldn't have to run back home. That's regular. What is the regular Navy? The regular Navy, ask anybody, or the regular Army, they're the ones that are outfitted, loaded up, suited up, ammoed up. They're ready to go at a moment's notice. We used to have what we called, I remember them, we had, they weren't mine, they belonged to the country, I suppose, combat-ready Marines. Combat-ready Marines. Those fellows, when I was overseas, lived in the mud all the time. They took a bulldozer and they'd doze out a big place, and those Marines would have to build their tents in the mud in the tropical weather and just live there. They wanted them to stay there all the time and be ready at a moment's notice to leave, to go and fight wherever they're told to go and fight. They were regular Marines, regular Navy. They were always at sea, ready. Well, no, they are now. They used to be that way. I'm trying to, as you did, and you did an excellent job of describing regular, and I appreciate you bringing those things up. That's the meaning. These lawyers here touched on it. It applies to both the Second Amendment, regular, and the same kind of a meaning applies to the Interstate Commerce Clause. We've turned that on its head to the point now where the federal government as using the Interstate Commerce Clause to impede commerce. There's just a lot of things you can't do. And if you get caught doing it, they'll send you to jail. And I've defended a gal once, a grandmother, never had a traffic ticket in her life, in federal court. She was charged with crossing a state line with intent to commit murder. It was crazy. She never went to jail, but what a ridiculous. If you're going to prove that she had this certain attitude in her head right when she crossed the state line from California into Nevada and vice versa, that's what they said. Well, that's the kind of thing the federal government's doing now, abusing the word regular and regulate. For them now, see, regulate means we have the power to impede, whereas regulate meant and means in our Constitution that government doesn't have the power to impede. It must be kept free-flowing. Well, I've beat that horse enough. I probably ought to get off of it. I hope I made myself clear. I tried hard. Maybe I tried too hard.
No, yes, you did. Thank you very much. I guess just one more follow-up would be, when they talk about banning any particular type of weapon because it looks like a military weapon, why isn't the Miller case brought to bear? Because it prohibits the banning of any weapons that are commonly used in the military.
You make an excellent point. Now, some people will say, and they'll make an argument, that what the Miller says about military weapons is obiter dictum. Obiter dictum. Obiter means over, and dictum means words. Words over and above the question presented in the case, and so are not binding. Well, that may or may not be true. I would say it's not true. But the Supreme Court takes the opportunity to deliver its opinion on any point. Then fellow should look at it real close and decide whether or not it's binding. He should give it good and hard look. And when I say binding, it's part of our common law tradition that court decisions bind us. Now, that can get us in trouble, I understand that, but never forget, our common law, the law is called the law of the land. That's the old name for it. And all of the rest of the world is under the law of the city, and the policy, the tradition of the law of the city is that judges can't interpret the statute. They can't. That's the unwritten part of their law. The statute, the code, they're not allowed to interpret it. They're only required to apply it as the powers that be tell them to. You see, a judge in the rest of the world, and when I say the rest of the world, I mean all the rest of the world except the common law countries, this English-speaking world, there are only about five. All of the world, it's against the law. Judges, by the way, are not lawyers. They're trained as judges, and they hold their job and their salary at the whim of the powers that be. They're utterly controlled. And the judge is not a lawyer. His job is not to interpret the law. His job is to obey the command of the legislator, whether it's a dictator or the single will of a legislature. Still, it's a single will. It's his duty to obey it. That's the policy of the law of the city. It is the tradition. It is the custom. It is the foundational custom of the law of the city that they're bound not to look ever at any legal precedent, any court decision before them that has gone before. We in the common law world look for guidance, and we try to discern the thread that threads through all the cases on a particular subject. For example, you mentioned the Miller decision. You know, it's funny, curious, in the sense, like old Huckleberry Hound used to say, not funny, ha-ha, funny, she. Like, what's this? It's curious that from the history of our country beginning, in the beginning in 1776, there's nothing said about the Second Amendment by our courts, hardly at all, until we get to the Miller decision, 1939. Some, but not hardly anything. And then, after that, it became a subject. And you can trace, for example, Miller, 1939, and then trace the thread through Miller, the thread through Heller versus D.C. versus Heller, and the McDonald versus City of Chicago. And take those three cases, read them. If you really want to understand the Second Amendment, Heller does a beautiful job of setting forth all of the history in England, all the history in the United States. And it's kind of curious because Scalia, of course, upheld it. Scalia was an odd man because he was committed, utterly committed to the Roman priesthood, hardcore Roman Catholic. I believe he had a son who was a priest. But in all of that, he tried to be a common lawyer. But in his heart of hearts, what he ended up doing was taking the Constitution, because your religious point of view will dictate ultimately your point of view about right and wrong, and that's law, friends, neighbors, and relatives. But ultimately, he viewed our Constitution as a statute, not a set of first principles. That's Romanism. That's the canon law. That's the priesthood. That's the code of Justinian. I'm thankful for him because he tried hard, but he just couldn't shake his religious convictions or his religious tradition. But to trace, as Justice Manfield put it back about the time our country started, to trace that thread through the record of cases, of courts of record, and say, what is the one thing that stands out in this thread that never changes in these cases? Well, go back and read Miller, D.C. versus Heller, and McDonald versus City of Chicago, and you'll begin to see a thread. And you'll say, okay, that's it. And what we need is members of the militia of the several states of the United States to come to grips, really, with the common law's understanding of the militia of the several states, because that's what the Second Amendment is. It's brief. Doesn't explain anything. None of our Constitution explains anything. Doesn't explain what a jury is. Doesn't explain what due process is. It doesn't explain what freedom of speech, freedom of religion. All of those things have a centuries and centuries and centuries old history that tells us what those are. And that's the thing that our founders and our, I call them the ratifiers of our Constitution, are our founders, really. that's what they wanted, and that's what they referred to. Am I still
okay.
there? Yeah, I guess I
am. Yep, you're here. All right, we'll take our next person. Let's see. Thanks, Don. Okay, let's go to Jody. Jody from Michigan. Go right ahead, Jody. You got the mic.
Hi. Thank you for bringing up this subject. It does concern me because I was entered into the lien system through the courts here in Michigan, and I have no offenses with any kind of firearm, and I'm not a threat to anyone. I was going to ask you to clarify the cases for me, which you did just do that because I didn't hear them all. But would these be good cases for me to try to fight with the courts again to try to get my gun rights returned to me?
Well, what I would suggest is this. This is all-out war. It's all-out war. And as long as our courts are open, it's my conviction we should use them. It's a war of words and information. It's a war of spirits. If you lose your temper or say things that get off track and hobby horse the wrong thing, you won't get anywhere. And if you're going to go into court, you must find a lawyer who you really believes what you believe, and is outraged by what has happened and will help you. Now, in the meantime, what I suggest to you is this, and I use the example of many men in history, but foremost, I use the example of Paul the Apostle. Paul the Apostle, unlike folks that claim to be Christian today, celebrities, and all of a sudden they become experts on the subject. And they're introduced in front of large audiences and they give their quote, end quote, testimony. And they don't know beans from sour apple butter about what they're talking about. And oftentimes they get wiped out. I can cite examples of those kind of things through the years. People fall back into evil and do all sorts of crazy things because they don't know the battle they're fighting. They don't understand what they're up against. And most Americans don't. I don't say that in derogation of any man or woman, because how could you know? You look at what happens and then they come down on you, maybe, with force, like a ton of bricks, and you have to shake it off and say, what's going on here? I thought that we lived in America, et cetera. And I can't believe they want to do this to me. I don't believe it. And even then, when they come back and slap you upside the head again or stick a dog on you, you still want to think that they're not as bad as you're seeing. You can't believe your eyes and your ears. And you're disgruntled. And I use Paul the Apostle as an example because when that happened to him, and God knocked him off his horse, and that's not an analogy, he knocked him off his horse, he landed on the road, God struck him blind, he couldn't see. He didn't just go and try to take over. He ran into the wilderness for 3 years, the bushland, and he spent time alone with the writings of legal significance, namely the Bible. And he studied them and contemplated them. And here's a man who probably has the equivalent of 2, maybe 3 PhDs today. He recognized that he did not know what he was doing. He was all of a sudden introduced to a world and a conflict that was ultimate, the ultimate conflict. And he didn't understand that that's what it was really all about. As he said later to the Corinthians, when I did all those ugly things and I was jailing people and stealing their property and having them murdered, I did them in ignorance. I did not understand what I was doing. Well, God slapped him down, blinded him, then opened his eyes. But he didn't jump in and try to become a teacher. He probably could have, but he would have failed miserably. And I say that to anybody that's been hit by the force of the evil empire, because you've spent your life, in most cases, all of us have, thinking there was something good about other people, something good about the evil empire didn't have the foothold. We didn't think it had that big a foothold. I got into politics. I ran for Congress. And I went down to the courthouse, asked him how to do that. And the clerk looked at me. I knew him, little county, rural county. He said, well, you know somebody that wants to run? I said, yeah, me. I had my bib overalls on. I just finished the feeding. And he said, you? I said, yeah, me. County. Oh, he said, okay, let's get the books down and see what it is you got to do. I don't know. We got some books around here. We'll figure it out. Well, I thought, and in good faith, that there was trouble, and I knew that things were going the wrong way, but I didn't understand the viciousness of what was really going on behind the scenes that seldom seen, and the enemy doesn't want you to see it. Well, when I got close to winning, then the enemy bared its teeth at me and showed itself to me. And then I began to understand. And that's why I say I don't say that in derogation of any man. No person can understand. If you're in that position, Jody, what I suggest you do is you spend time trying to learn, trying and struggling. It's a struggle. You got to wrestle with it and learn what's going on. In the meantime, if you've got law pressing in on you, you need legal counsel if they're really coming at you hard. You don't have time to learn it. You don't have time to prepare yourself, to go to boot camp, to get training, and then go fight the fight. They're going to fight right now. Right now, it sounds like. If that's the case, you correct me if I'm wrong, but if that's the case, you need legal counsel that you can trust to do the job. That may take some looking.
Yeah, it's very difficult to find a lawyer that is in agreement with me. I'm actually having a very difficult time finding legal counsel, period, other than court-appointed. And in my opinion, the court-appointed attorney may as well sit on the opposite side of the aisle than the one that I sit on.
Yes.
They are ineffective of counsel, in my opinion. And can I ask your opinion on this? When I speak to the judge, and I've heard many other people have this complaint and problem before in courts, they ignore what you say. What is your rationale for that? Why do they do that?
They do that because they can get away with it. Of course, what is better to do, especially a person like you that's representing yourself, is to make sure that you get your what you want to say in a document filed in the court. Make sure you expound it well. Be brief. Don't expound it too much. But it hit the nail on the head, 2 or 3 pages is enough in most cases, and make sure and get the solid case law. Again, not more than 2 or 3 cases. No more than 3 witnesses, the Bible says. You got 2 or 3 cases, that's enough. Get them in there. Make your arguments. That way it's on the record. Because always remember, don't think about winning right now in court. If you do, you're going to be discouraged. Don't think about it. Don't expect it. Make sure, just keep plodding away toward appeal. That's what you need to do. Oh, I know it's a long haul. But every lawyer, if a lawyer didn't do that and think that way, he'd go crazy. Because you get worried about every little encounter. That's not where the war is won. The war is won by persistence. Listen, George Washington refused to face the British Army for 7 years. 7 years! He played catch me, and he didn't want to face the British Army because he knew that he'd get whipped. And so he just kept engaging here and there in skirmishes. But when he finally thought that he had what it took to defeat them, and he could pick the field, he did, and he terminally whooped the British Army, and we are a new nation because of it, and that's what happened. But he wasn't a fool. He was not a fool. He who fights and runs away may live to fight another day, but he who is in battle slain shall never arise to fight again. That's true. Jesus Christ said it this way. When a military general officer, he didn't say it, just, but I'm giving you the rundown of what he said, goes to fight a battle, he counts the cost. Jesus Christ said he counts the cost, and he doesn't do it if he doesn't think he can win. He said also in the Sermon on the Mount, that famous line, do not resist evil. Well, poor translation. What it says is, the Greek text says, do not square off with the evil one. Do not do it. Because if you do, he's going to whoop you. I tell my clients, the guys you're up against here in this federal case, these are the guys that have aircraft carriers and the United States Marine Corps and all the federal agencies, and they're all armed anymore. Do not square off with them. Jesus Christ says then, what do? You be as wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove, you've got to fight the guerrilla war. That's the war you're fighting. You stand up to a police officer with dogs and pistols. You're armed with nothing but your fist, and they're surrounding you. They've got the drop on you. Don't be a fool. You'll get killed. And plenty of men have gotten killed that way. This is an ultimate game. We must know what the law is. We must know what the battle plan is. Jesus Christ gives it to us in certain terms. And if we would but contemplate it, we would win, and we will win. But he wants us to. God, in human flesh, the Messiah of mankind, tells us how to do it. And there are many writings of our common law where men have observed in nature these truths and written them down, just like I quoted that fellow that says, he who fights and runs away may live to fight another day. Do not square off, said Jesus Christ, with the evil one. Don't draw a line in the sand and say, okay, we're going to have a Viking-like contest and we're going to deliver blow for blow. You're going to lose. That's what I'm trying to get across. And so what you need to do is be wise, and you need to be patient. Here's another common law precept. And it's come to us from ancient times. It's been taken in. Beware the fury of a patient man. Beware the fury of a patient man. That's George Washington. The British ought to have been beware. And he was furious, by the way. You know why he was furious? He was furious because the British officer corps would never accept him during the French and Indian War. Why? Because he was a colonial. He didn't have any class. And they were going to let him have the privileges they had. And he held that grudge his entire life against the British. And when he saw the opportunity, and he saw they were doing wrong, and he saw that they were part of a plan to use germ warfare against the American colonials, that they called them, and wipe out all 3 million of them to a man using smallpox to infect the Negro population of slaves. And that's what they were going to do. Washington said, no, not on my watch. I'm going to get him. This is my chance. Beware the fury of a patient man. Learn the game and don't quit. Stay with it and you'll win. You will win. And that's what I would say. You're facing evil empire.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Jody. Okay, we're going to move over to Gerard. Thank you very much, Brent. We appreciate your time. Anybody else has any questions, you can hit *6 to come into the queue. Gerard, are you here? Hello, Gerard. Unmute yourself if you're talking. Gerard? I'll wait till Gerard gets back. Meanwhile, I'll take the whatever questions or comments people may have. We're going to open to... any questions? *6 to get into the Q&A. *6. And we'll take the next person. How you doing, Ed? Ed from Connecticut. You should have the mic. Can you hear me? Ed?
Okay, I'm here. I just had to unmute myself.
Okay.
Hi, John.
How
yeah,
doing,
good. It's great, you know, all the things you're doing. And
how
I
you
just
guys
want...
working out there for preparing for, you know, me coming out and doing something in the center of the state and getting things together for committees of safety? Are you working with the rest of the group on that?
Well, I have some people that are working on that, yeah.
Okay.
So it's fantastic, all the things that are happening. One thing I just want to, you know, because obviously the focus with the Constitution and everything, if the way it's presently set and set with the actually within the Constitution itself, the government has the ability to change the Constitution. But that goes against what Jefferson was saying as far as that it's there to protect us from a tyrannical government. So I, you know, so for them
right,
to
well,
have
the government
ability,
does the government doesn't have the authority to change the Constitution.
Well, isn't it with Article 5? They can both houses with a 2/3 majority could make the change.
Well,
I'd
have to read through it to be a little more precise. Maybe if Brent's here, he can respond a little to more to that than I can. But generally speaking, this would be some amendments can be made. I'm not too sure that the way they've been doing amendments is all that correct, because look at, they're trying to do constitutional convention here in New York, and they've been trying to do that for a while. And one of the points that Bob Schultz is arguing is that the delegates that would sit at that constitutional convention cannot be elected individuals. They need to be the people. And I agree 100% with him on that. If we're going to have a constitutional convention, which there is no need for, we the people have to be addressed on that, in my opinion. Now, they could make some corrections here or this or that. They haven't done such a very good job, in my opinion. They haven't done anything in any of these amendments that they've made over the last 200 years that have done any good to the Constitution, per se. As a matter of fact, if anything, they caused problems. They caused problems with the 17th Amendment. They've caused problems, of course, the 16th Amendment. I mean, goodness. And some of the other amendments that might be okay, they played with wording in there, and I think they were trying to move us into slave language or something, which is some which a lot of people believe, and they're probably right on that, because, again, they have the Organic Act of 1871, which they're trying to construct on, and I believe some of these things are constructed upon that. They're probably right on that. We don't really need a lot of these other things. So we do have a major problem with that. Thankfully, it's very difficult for them to make amendments, and it's very difficult for them to have a constitutional convention. So we need to do is, and they didn't take that route. I know they did take, they tried to take that route, but I don't think they did a very good job at it. And now they're taking a different route by destroying our economy, which they've done a really good job on that over the past 40 or so years. Longer than that, actually. They've been working on that since the turn of the century. And we're not talking about this past century, the one before. And, they've done a really good job at destroying our economy and sending business overseas and everywhere else but in the United States and giving us nothing but inflation and making us to the point where we produce nothing and we're dependent upon productions of materials coming from other countries. They're destroying our food and even polluting our water. I mean, these people are just nothing but destroyers, and that's what they've done a very good job at that. And I don't know how well a job they have done in preparing for the final destruction upon us, which is coming soon, that they're going to try to do through the monetary collapse, I believe. That's just going to cause chaos, at least they're hoping for that. And it's going to cause chaos, it's going to cause upheaval, and it's going to cause a situation where they'll claim they need to put in martial law, and of course we'll never come out of that. Once government gets power and you give it to military power, that military will never be controlled by the president again, only by the oligarchy behind that president, and we'll never see liberty again. And that's why it's so important for us to really get moving. Anybody dragging their feet on this issue, they're not committing, making committees of safety, shame on you. It's time to get moving on this, people. If you're not involved in making the committees of safety, shame on you. You're not doing your duty. Maybe you're not getting the message clear enough. Go back and listen to the tapes. Because we have hard times coming, and we could make it softer. We could make it much more comfortable. We could make it much more tolerable. We could win. And we can win without firing a bullet if we do what we have to do now. Now is the time. And I'm going to read Kennedy one more time. And I really wish people would take Kennedy to heart. Okay? In my opinion, Kennedy was the greatest president in my lifetime. That's my opinion, and I truly believe that. I don't care what they said about Kennedy. It's all BS. I don't believe it at all. Not a word of it. You know, you just say you have to destroy the characters of people because you can't destroy his message, and he had great messages. You couldn't destroy his message, so you cover up his message and you just get people to look at the smut that they throw out there, you know. But he said a revolution is coming, a revolution which will be peaceful if we are wise enough. Are we wise enough to make this a peaceful revolution? Because that's what we're trying to do with committees of safety, to make this thing peaceful. You know, we want to be compassionate and peaceful. We don't want to fire a gun. We don't want to end up at the end of a barrel of a gun, because that's where they want to take us. A revolution is coming, a revolution which will be peaceful if we are wise enough, compassionate if we care enough. Do you care? Are you caring enough to go out and create the committees of safety in your county and work to the rest throughout your state to get committees of safety so you have a consolidated state, one working together in one accord to make sure that the people are safety, to make sure that we can protect ourselves, to make sure that we can protect the Constitution, our unalienable rights, to make sure that at the end of this disaster that is heading towards America, that we will continue to stand with liberty and justice? We don't have much of that today anyway, but are we going to get back to it? Are we going to lose it all forever? But a revolution which is coming, whether we will it or not, we can affect its character. We cannot alter its inevitability. Remember that. We can affect its character. We cannot alter its inevitability. It is coming. No one can stop it. Save God himself, of course. No one can stop this revolution that is about to hit America like a brick house. The question is, can we make a peaceful and gentle landing, or is it going to be a hard fall, you know?
Right, yeah.
Anyway.
It's a very good comments you made there. Yeah, like I was saying, that, you know, the people, I truly believe the people should be the only ones with the ability to make any amendments, because if it's there to protect us against them, how could they possibly have the right to alter it? That way they could, when they see things are going our way, they could just alter it. So it's like, you know, changing you're playing a game of Monopoly, right?
Yeah, they could. Look, this is what they tried to do. They couldn't really get to, even with the way that it's written, that they could make the amendments. A constitutional convention is a whole different thing. But even with the arrangements they made to make the amendments, it's still been minimum, okay? It's still been difficult. And they never were able to really conclude on the matter, okay? They de-educated us, if you want to use a term like that. You know, they made us ignorant. We have no real education, okay? And they say that we are, you know, the most advanced, today, our children, with all this technology and stuff. But it's all untrue. It's all BS. People don't know what liberty is. If you don't know what body politics is, and you don't know what the judiciary is all about, then you're ignorant. Everyone, there's not a man, woman, or child, and child meaning 15, 16 years old, and not a very young child, there's not a man, woman, or child that should not be able to walk into a court of law and be able to defend themselves and understand the process, because it really isn't that difficult when you get rid of all of the double talk and all of the the statutes, and you just get down to it. It ultimately is facts and procedure, okay? Ultimately, I mean, there are some real laws, but most of them don't apply to us. It applies to them, because we never gave them the ability to make statutes to control us. We gave them the ability to write statutes within a certain criteria to control them. And we've got some good stuff out there, some good code for that for that process. But in what I've studied, if only I had a teacher that could have given me what I really needed. You know, I went to the School of Hard Knocks and hit and miss and hit and miss and hit and miss, and you get it right a little, and then you get a little bit of an understanding here and an understanding there, And it just takes a little while, but people can learn what I know. I personally think people can learn what I learn in a year or so. It's really, in my point of view, it's really state of mind. That's what I think law is all about, understanding jurisdiction, understanding due process, understanding what the law of the land is. These are states of mind. Because, you know, understanding liberty is a state of mind. It's not, you can read the words and not understand one word of it. I mean, look at how many people have a constitution and they can read the words and they don't understand one word of it. Because it's more than just words. It's a concept, and it really goes back to property, the right of property, which goes back to the right of your body. It's between you and your maker and how you treat your body and how you deal with your body. You got to answer to the maker at the end. You don't have to answer to any other man. But the laws are really pretty simple, and, injury is required, an injured party is required, in order to make a case in a court of law. And if there is no injured party, there is no case. There must be, and the only thing necessary to make a good case or prima facie case is a sworn affidavit, period. You need nothing else. But they have made this thing difficult. They want you to get their bar lawyers so that they can take you down the road of foreign jurisdictions and total destruction, and that's it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. No, you have it laid out. It's very simple. Yeah, one quick thing. I remember about a month or so ago you mentioned about Trump. Is he, you were saying something that he does recognize the importance of the Constitution, and a bit about what we're doing, or is there any update on that?
Yeah, I don't think that Trump understands that much about the Constitution, but I do think he understands a lot more than any of these politicians out there. He gets a lot of things wrong because he's got certain attitudes and mindsets concerning from the businessman's perspective, and he's used statutes and mishaps of law in order to benefit from them, and he comes at things from the business point of view. But with all that said, I do think he's got a good heart. I don't know for sure. I don't know the man personally, but from all I know of him, he's got a good heart. I've listened to what he said over the years, going back even 30 years ago, 25 years ago. What Trump's position back then is the same as his position today. And he has taken a stand on what went out there in Oregon against the BLM. He has taken a stand. He has made statements, and he has called them tyrants. I don't know if he used that word, but if he didn't use that word, it was something as strong as that. We have sent him all of our paperwork to let him know what we're doing. He hasn't responded. We didn't expect him to respond. We don't need him to respond. We just want to let him know we're out here, we're doing things. I think Trump is a controllable guy in the sense that if he steps out of line, you can control him and he'll step back in. If we, the people, take back the judiciary, I think he could be a really good guy for us, maybe. But again, I don't know the heart of the man. I really don't know, but I kind of feel that it might be something, and again, God's setting the stage here, well, let's see what happens. I don't know.
Right. Excellent. Yeah, no, your recall was good. Right. It was originally, I think you mentioned about him because of his comments on Oregon and then the paperwork. And I was just hoping there was maybe some kind of response from somebody in his campaign.
Well, I wish he would respond with a check,
Yeah, right, exactly. That would be nothing for him. It's funny, as a coincidence, he came out to Fairfield, Connecticut on Saturday night. There's obviously record crowds there and so forth. And he commented, people came out and it's, like 100 degrees and people have better things to do, but they were there. And such a group, and his crowds are getting big, always big numbers. And of course, he always comments how the press never shows his crowds; they only just show him.
He's about the only guy that can get away with just saying anything he wants about the press, and he does. And they can't do a damn thing about it, you know, because he's got that name and he's got that recognition and he's got that power from the business perspective. And he's got a lot of clout. So, you know, I like when he rips on the press. And what he says about the press is absolutely true. These people have betrayed us. They belong to be tried for treason. They had a duty and they did not keep that duty. And and therefore, when we get to the other side, the people's going to have to decide. I think a lot of people in the press will be indicted, and it'll be up to the people to decide in a court of law and on what that is for who, you know, whatever it is that they think they have to decide. Mainly, there are a lot of people that deserve to be tried for treason. That's the bottom line, in my opinion.
Understood. Well, listen, thank you very much for your comments, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, Gerard, by the way, if you're back. Yep.
Ollie just got some really bad news he'd like to share with us. Could we unmute him now and let him talk from it?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Go ahead, Ollie.
Yes. Bad news. Joe Robertson was 77. He was under VA health care. He had his therapy dog. Okay. The VA health care in that region is just like I've got here. It is best in nation. Okay. They sentenced him, of course, when they took him out, he no longer had his therapy dog, and of course they wouldn't let him take his VA meds. He was in the hospital that night with severe chest pains. It took him a week to stabilize his meds. When they got his meds stabilized, they immediately shipped him up to Shelby. This private detention center is owned by the same company that Almond Bundy is in down in Las Vegas, okay? They got him up there. They denied him calls. They denied him visitation. After about a week, he got a hold. He called down to Missoula, got a hold of Carrie on somebody else's phone and said he still hadn't had any meds. This weekend, he's in the hospital all weekend. He had a very severe stroke. It had something to do with his eyes, his loss of vision. He's got double vision. He's got severe chest pains. And like I say, he's 77 years old. And they are killing him is what they are doing. They're killing him. And I just cry. I thought I could do something for that man, but it just... It's hard getting help. It's hard getting help. And it's just so sad. They're killing him. They're killing him.
All right. Well, what we do need is people that are familiar with this case that will write us affidavits concerning things that the judge has done and said, people who have been in the courts, how he's been deprived of his right of a due process. And we do have a habeas corpus in for him. We have moved for them. I'm not exactly sure where we are in the case because we got a little more too involved in what was going on up in Oregon. But I am focusing my focus on him tomorrow, and we'll be looking into finishing some more paperworking and going after these people.
I am getting an affidavit from John Lamb on the clerk's behavior.
Not only that, we need people who can write an affidavit concerning what exactly you told us about his meds and now that he's in the hospital. We need an affidavit of pretty much what you said. So we need that knowledge on paper. With a signature, swearing to what those facts are, so that we can now go after the judge. We can now go after these institutions that they have privatized, that they call prisons, because that's what these are, private institutions now. And these people are destructive. They're evil. They have no compassion, and they don't care. And this man never should have been, even at worst case, he could have been fined. And that's at worst case. That's at worst case. And even that would have been unjust with what went down out there in Montana. And so we'll do the best we can. But anybody that has knowledge of this case or knows somebody who has knowledge of this case that can write affidavits concerning all of these injustices, let's get them done. Let's get the information to Ollie. And Ali will upload it to us.
If I could get somebody Lindsay talked to Carrie, I think she said last Thursday, if Lindsay talked to Carrie, his wife, on the phone, could Lindsay make an affidavit from that phone call about the meds and all this and that?
With his wife?
Yeah.
Can his wife do it?
She's frightened. The people up there are frightened.
Let's do it. Let's do it third party. And look it. These are extraordinary times. We have, through habeas corpus, through what's called Next Friend, set aside habeas corpus, through Next Friend, okay, the U.S. code that permits us to write affidavits, secondhand information, okay, as if it's an affidavit. So anybody that is in prison, someone outside that prison can talk to that person, phone or in person, get the details, and write an affidavit on their behalf as if it's them writing. In this case, she should write it up, okay, in the way that the second-hand, third-hand information, that this information has come to the wife and so on and so forth, and if she doesn't mind her to at least say also that she's frightened to do the affidavit, but just write the facts, okay? I think they're too dumb to realize it anyway, to be honest with you. But if not, we'll make a position on this, and maybe we'll push them. Well, okay, then let's get someone in there to talk to them and see what they say the truth is, and we'll let him sign an affidavit, or let someone else that can go talk with him sign the affidavit as a next friend. But I don't think that they're bright enough to know anyway. We just got to reveal their sins on paper. And we got to make them go on the defense. We need to be on that offense and not let up. And we're about ready to do that on this case.
Okay,
we have filed some papers in there. We filed for his release. They've ignored that. We're going to go after the clerk. We'll stop putting pressure on the clerk. We've got about four papers we can file in that case right now. All of them are assault of papers. In other words, going after the people who are breaking the law. Someone did concealment here, and we can prove it. We've got the certified copies. We've never received the papers back. They've received the papers, and then they concealed them. And we'll go after the clerk, and the clerk will probably break if we put enough pressure on the clerk, and say, well, look, I only did what the judge told me to do. Well, that's fine. You're going to be a witness for that, you know, because they have a duty to speak, by the way. And the bottom line is if they don't speak, then we're going to presume then you're guilty of concealment, and we're going to deal with that before the grand jury. And that's how we'll go after them and put the pressure on them. And I think we can break them that way. We need to go after the judge because we've put papers in, and the judge knows that these papers went in. You know that the judge knows, and the judge is probably the one that told the clerk not to let him go through. Don't put him in the docket. We know that. We don't know absolutely, but we're pretty sure that is the case. I can't believe a clerk is going to make a decision like that on themselves.
Well, you can't either. Anyway, back to Portland. Kelly is fighting for Ryan. She's going to go down and see the county sheriff tomorrow. Could she? She didn't ask you. This is just a thought of mine. Is there something she could do with a file on demand, or something else, and put some pressure on the sheriff?
No, what we spoke about in the meeting tonight is what we need. Tomorrow's meeting, we'll see where we got to get. We've got three or four papers we can file for him also, but again, we need the affidavits, we need the pictures, we need the details. We have some already, and we want to hit them up also with three or four papers at the same time, one after another. We have to bring these people to their knees, and we do that by filing truth and putting the fear of the truth being known by the people, and they start to realize that maybe they're going to start going to jail because, you know, that's where we put the fear. We have to just tell the truth and get it onto, and then get it into the news, you know, whatever news outlets we can get. Let's do that also. She's going to see the sheriff who's in charge of the prison?
Yeah, that's...
Okay, we're going to try to do an order of protection for him against the sheriff's department. Now, what are they going to do with that? How are they going to keep him in prison if we have an order of protection? And that order of protection will extend. He can't be sent to a private institution. And also, they're not violent people. We can prove that. So, look, they got problems, and we just have to get the information out as quick as possible. But we need affidavits.
Should I advise her, seeing the sheriff tomorrow? What should I advise her?
Well, she can make mention that the grand jury is looking into all this and also has already received a affidavit concerning the incident that took place in the jail, and they'll be hearing from us soon. Maybe that'll put a little fear to back off.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I'm not going in. I'd walk in, I'd rip the badge right off his chest, and I'd say, you're done. Adios. And then
we can do that.
Yeah, I would go talk to under sheriff or some deputy with some support, and I would walk in and I would do it.
Can't wait to do that. I mean, would like to take the badges off of some of these guys, you know. So
okay, one more small statement, and then I'll relinquish. My county sheriff, okay. I did urges, okay. I got leprechauns telling me what to do. I don't know, but I got an urge, and my county sheriff, he's logged on Facebook. When there's things going down, he's logged on Facebook because he depends more on social media than the corporate media. I just sent him a PM, and I said, Sheriff, give me some advice of what we got to do with all of the prisoner abuse in Multnomah County. And he writes back and he says, well, you got to, the defense attorney's got to put some pressure on that, you know. So I didn't answer him. Milwaukee
hit.
That's
a joke. That's humor. Yeah.
Milwaukee hit. Okay. Now, lo and behold, over the weekend, two of his sheriffs suffered from this hate cop campaign, see? So then I hit him this morning and I said, Sheriff, the reason Milwaukee is going down and the reason you had trouble over the weekend is because of these sheriffs that are not doing their job. I says, you sheriffs have got to go to your associations and you've got to put pressure on these sheriffs that are not doing their job, because let me tell you what, if they don't, they're gonna have problems in their county, just like in Milwaukee. They have got to wake up and they've got to start putting pressure on these sheriffs that are not doing their job. I'm done.
Yeah, there's only one way these sheriffs are gonna wake up, and that's if the people wake them up. Committees of safety, that's what that is all about, okay?
Yep.
Committees of safety.
Yep.
We need to make sure we educate these sheriffs. We need to make sure they understand their duties. And we need to make sure that they start to execute that and start to bind together with the people in their community and bind together with the other good sheriffs across the nation. And if they don't do that, we're going to lose America. And they need to understand that.
Yep. They need to understand if they don't start doing their job, their county, they're going to wind up with Milwaukee in their county, period. And big time. Okay, well, thanks, John. Well, I wanted to give you that news, and I'll talk at you later. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Okay, we'll take our next questioner. Let's see. It looks like Tim from Michigan. You've got the mic, Tim.
Thank you. My question tonight is a two-part question. It's directed to John and possibly Mr. Winters, if he's still by the mic. Part A, are all Americans under the jurisdiction and the authority of the vicar of a diocese in your state? And Part B, is the vicar part of the Catholic Church or the Church of England or both? Thank you.
Well, I can answer part of that and tell you that we the people are under nobody's authority but God's. Period. They're under our authority. Now, they can create their fiction, and we cannot react to their fiction. And I say this all the time. And some of the people that are still talking about the man on the land, and they talk about the fiction and this and that and the other thing, and they think if they say the right words in the court and click their heels together that they're going to be set free. They're laughing at you. They want you to take that route. And then they're going to make you look like a nut. And then they're going to force a lawyer upon you because they'll get a psychological on you. And that's what they'll use it for, especially in the cases that they're concerned about. They love to do that. And they'll feed, and we're seeing it take place in some cases we're dealing with right now, where they actually send people in to do these things, to get these people the information, to do this stupid stuff. But look, if you acknowledge a fiction as reality, then reality is the way one perceives it, and that's what you got. If you call the fiction what it is, a fraud, and ignore it and bring the truth, and whatever codes you can bring in that are constitutional, and there's a lot of stuff out there, that we got a lot of ammo. I'll tell you what, I never worry about any case that I get involved with. I know I can beat it because all I have to do, there's plenty of ammo out there. There's a lot of codes you can use, a lot of federal codes. There's the Constitution. There's the U.S. Supreme Court rulings. I mean, hey, we can go out. I don't care what they throw at us. We can come out and make arguments that they don't even have a chance. They won't even come back a second time because they never do. They can't answer the first part when we destroy them after they, if they try with the stupid things that they come out and say. It's real dumb. So, but as far as who these vicars are, and I don't know anything about those things. I don't know if Brent does, and he can comment if he's still here. It just hit star six there, Brent.
Yeah, I hit star six. I could make a comment or two with your permission.
Yeah, right.
Vicar is an old Latin word that means in place of. For instance, the Pope of Rome calls himself and has for centuries the Vicar of Christ. The Vicar of Christ. In other words, he has claimed for many centuries to be the man that stands in place of Christ on earth and has all the authority of Christ and has power over armies and nations, and that's the official part of the church. On and on it goes, and only his foot is to be kissed, etc. The vicar of Christ. And then also the individual archbishops and bishops, they have vicars that stand in their place. Some people call them agents or deputies of this archbishop or whatever, but vicar is a preposition. It's used many different ways, but in the religion and in the Episcopal Church, for instance, he's a deputy of the bishop of that church, and he vicar of the church, and he controls things. And vicar of Christ, he stands in place of Christ. But most fascinatingly, and this is ignored, I don't know why, but the word anti in the Greek New Testament, and the New Testament was written in Greek, the word anti means in place of. And Antichrist means the one who claims to stand in the place of Christ. And there is not one Antichrist, according to the Bible. There are many. And many men through the centuries have claimed to be God on earth. And that, of course, is the claim of all tyrants. They may not say they're God, but all tyrants say, there is no power beyond me on earth. I am the final court of last resort. And what I say goes, and that ends the matter. I am the lawgiver, the one from whose decision there is no earthly, keyword earthly, appeal. I stand in the place of Christ. I stand in the place, therefore, of God, because Christ is God, reduced to the span of a man. And if somebody wants to argue about that, then go argue with the Bible and God. The Bible's clear on that point. I can't change it. That's the way it is. It's my job to report what it says, and it's not obscure. Those statements are clear, and they're throughout Scripture. Jesus Christ is God. The claim to stand in this place is to be anti-God. That means to claim to stand in the place of God. And, of course, the Bible teaches that those things are evil. There is no vicar in a religious sense in America that has any authority over anyone. They may have power. They may have delusion. As Thomas Jefferson put it, wherever you see the priesthood of religion, any religion, the priesthood will couple himself with the tyrant. Always, always, always. And that's the history of priesthood throughout the world, whether it be the Roman priesthood or whether it be some other priesthood or some other group of self-proclaimed elite who claim to have that power and that authority by some other name, some elite group. And Islamic law, for instance, there are those that are committed to be experts in the art of logic, and they're one of the ones that the different groups of Islam, who all hate each other and war against each other because they can't agree, but they agree that there is those hadiths, the men that can interpret the hadiths, they are the elite. And no one else is allowed to do that. Just as the priesthood of Rome, no one else is allowed to say what God has said except them. Well, they stand in the place of God, or so they say. There is no vicar, as John Wycliffe said, the great proponent of our common law, the first translator of the Bible into English. There is no institution, no priesthood, no man that stands between a man's creator and him. And that's the law of God. And he said every man must claim freedom under the open vault of heaven and remove themselves from the dark and dank cloisters of the monasteries and recognize the authority that God has given him. The whole idea of vicar is very dangerous. I can even show you places in the Newer Testament where the preposition anti is used to speak of copies of things, like, well, copies. That's what they mean, mirror images. And that's what a vicar is, someone who claims to be the mirror image of someone else and standing in his place with all of his delegated authority. And no, there is no vicar. The Supreme Court of the United States has said that it has no jurisdiction to delve into or ask questions or inquire about the inner workings of church government. No authority to do so. If there ever has been a violation of the First Amendment in our country, it was when John Bonner, by his orchestration, put it so that the bishop, the Roman bishop, could come and speak to the United States Congress. If he's got the right to speak to Congress, we have no more First Amendment that's applicable, that's working at all. If that's not a violation of religion and freedom, religious freedom, rather, I don't know what is. But no, there is no vicar that has any jurisdiction over any American. Now, there are deputies, and the word vicar could be understood to mean deputy, like a sheriff's deputy. Or, when the posse is the posse comitatus, posse means the possibility, the power of the county. When they're called out, they are made, in the Latin tongue, vicars, because they're made deputies. However, they do have the authority of the sheriff, the deputy, vicar. By the way, vice, like vice president, same thing. Vice president, the man that stands in the place of the president, has all the power of the president if something incapacitates the president. Vice, vicar, and deputy is another one. That's anti in the Greek tongue is the same thing. The mirror image, the answer back. That's why we have anti-aircraft guns, for example. That's a little bit of a twist of the word anti, but it means vicar. But there is no vicar that has control over you to answer the ultimate question, or me, of any religious organization. They may have power, they may have delusion, but they don't have authority, jurisdiction, and right.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Okay, appreciate it, Tim. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Tim.
All right. Okay, next person, Crystal from Connecticut. How you doing, Crystal?
Hello.
Hey, how you doing, Crystal?
Oh, hanging in there. There's one other thing I heard you mention earlier, and about the with the land, and what they've been doing in Connecticut too, is when they've been taking people's property, illegal foreclosure, and now they're doing mine again. They're coming at me again with this crazy MRF. So I filed got most of my papers, and also I got the deed and stuff. But what they've been doing to a lot of people's property that they're unaware of is that the city, or the state, is taking people's property and giving themselves a 99-year lease. Okay? So, for example, wherever you see, like, new developments and things going on now, they own the land. So you're buying a house, but you don't own the land. So at any given time, 5-10 years down the road, they could turn around and say, well, this is our property. Or when people sit there, they've been, you know, $300,000 to $400,000, thinking that they own a house, and literally they don't, because they do not own the land and they're playing. The gated community, pay attention to that word, gated community, because you don't own the land. It's a high rent. And say, for instance, if something happens and you want to leave your estate, by the time they finish with you, you come out with zero and your estate gets nothing. So that's another thing that they're doing big time here.
You know, they take advantage of us of all these things because of our ignorance, because we run away from the law, okay? All we have to do is understand the true law, the law of the land, and then see what they're doing and bring it, try to bring it into a relationship, and you can't. You know, they use a process called in rem, and that is ultimately saying exactly what you're saying, is that they kind of own the land, and they're just coming to claim it. Because in rem is when someone comes at someone in rem, really, they're putting a stake on a property that they claim to have owned, and they're reclaiming it back, something that was robbed from them or something of that nature. And basically, that's what it is. Also, it also identifies with the prize, the right of a nation to seize a ship of piracy. Okay, if they capture a pirate ship and they tow it into shore. Back to their land, they claim it in rem because they have the right of that. So there's a right attached to it. So when these tax foreclosures come up particularly, you'll always find a lead back into the statutes within the county, which are probably state statutes, unless they – I don't remember. I remember we just wrote one up. I don't remember – I don't think there's such a thing as a county statute.
No.
Basically, there's state statute. But what happens is they – you'll always – if you go back and read their laws and the codes that they use in order to take your property away, okay, you'll find it leads right back to in rem, I-N-R-E-M, always. They're claiming ownership. We challenge them on that ownership, and they don't know how to answer that because – the lawyers don't even understand what it really means, to be honest with you.
One other thing I forgot to mention to you last week. Remember when I was telling you about the life use?
Mm-hmm.
The life use. I forgot the one big case we had many years ago. I remember when this happened back in the 70s. P.T. Barnum?
Yep.
Okay. Well, P.T. Barnum owned the whole Seaside Park area, the South End, all the waterfront property. And what he did, he left in his estate, in his will, he left the city of Bridgeport residence, the city Seaside Park, for 400 years. Well, back in the late 70s, I believe one of the former mayors, he had his mansion demolished, had a chain of a wrecking chain ball, and destroyed it. And, I mean, people were so upset about it. And I remember one of the attorneys found the paper because they were going to put all high-rising apartments and make it privatized. And I remember there was a big argument, and they were pulling out the deeds and all this. And one of the attorneys found, they go, you can't do that, because he left the city of Bridgeport, Seaside Park, for 400 years. And something jarred my memory when I remembered that. And it's just like when we do the life use, you could do that and leave it in your family for heir property for 400 or 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's something also that people can file.
Right. Yeah, but you gotta lay that out and people.
Yeah, but
I'm just saying
with the life use, if you put all their names down, like the Kennedys, like it's like a trust fund, but you could do it for X amount, so it stays on or heir property.
Right. But again, all these codes that these people use to do all their evil, look into them. You'll find out that they're not that tightly fit that they got any rights at all. Look at the IRS comes out at you with certain codes, and nobody ever reads the codes. Look
that's
at the codes that they're
right.
coming out after you. They're saying that you're doing business with alcohol and tobacco and firearms. I'm not doing any business with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I have nothing to do with that. I don't work for the government. Go read that stuff, and you'll discover, wait a second, how are you coming out after me with these codes? But nobody questions it. You got all these quote-unquote lawyers that work for the that try to make the battles against the IRS, and they're like parasites, And they don't even know this. Or maybe they do and they don't care.
But see, what's going on up here, you know, the older ones that aren't, they're not signing up for nothing, because when I sat there and said, I would like your, you know, your license, they only have a juris number. The ones who are collecting the debt is the attorneys, and they're the debt collectors. And what they're doing up here, they're getting all these new young attorneys that are signing their names, and they don't even know what they're signing about. Like when I went to court, they couldn't even fight me in court. And you know, the woman was as red as a beet. Well, this nut just wrote me another letter. So I said, okay, I just got it today. So, you know, the proof of claim. And as I said, remember I was telling you, also, it's on C and on Channel 69. It's called American Greed.
American Greed?
American Greed. Oh, my God. Everybody got to watch it. It's about everything we're all going through, from mortgage fraud, and they have this guy on there. His name was Mark Greer, and he embezzled so much. He was worse than Bernie Madoff, but Bernie Madoff put more money than this guy did. But it was like the perfect mastermind and how he was scamming people's homes, properties. He even got one of the big time, except one of his clients, for $20 million. And then when the people, because he was also a big part of like the Enron and all that. But it comes on, I'll tell you exactly, and you can go on your website. Everybody needs to sit there and take a crap on that. I mean, it was just like, it's okay. I'm going to give you the initials of it right now. Hold on 1 second. It's C as in cat, N as in Nancy, B as in boy, C as in Charlie. It's called American Greed, and those are the initials, .com.
Mm-hmm. CNBC.com?
Yes, and they have it. It's called American Greed. They had it on medical malpractice, illegal foreclosures, but they have every single document and stuff that, you know, what you're talking about. So I think all the callers definitely need to, and it comes on early in the morning, but you can go on your computer and you know. But, I mean, it's fascinating, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're running out of time here, so anything final? Because we've got to move on to the next person.
No, those are the only things I was trying to tell you.
Okay, Crystal. Thank
okay.
you.
You're welcome.
Bye. Okay, Larry from Indiana. Go right ahead.
Hey. Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go right ahead.
Oh, thank you for letting me talk. Not to change the subject too much, but getting back to the Melissa part, the Dick Act of 1902, I haven't heard anybody speak about that. And according to that, we can have anything that the military has. I was just wondering whether you was aware of it or not. That's all.
Well, yeah, I'm aware
of
the Dick Act. You're going to have to mute yourself
mute
while
yourself
I'm talking
off.
Or turn your fingers away from your mic. Because I'm hearing feedback.
How's that?
Okay, let's try this. No, what I'll do is I'll mute you until I'm done, and then I'll unmute you. So, we're familiar with the Dick Act. We've looked into it. We've got the Second Amendment. We can use that. I haven't read through it thoroughly. I've got some interpretation about it, and I've looked at it a little bit, but I've never used it. I like to go right for Constitution. If you got something in the Constitution, use the Constitution direct. It is interesting what Brent had brought up earlier concerning the fact of, the argument concerning what kind of weaponry you can have. You know, we definitely should be able to have assault weapons. Absolutely. We have to have weapons that we can defend ourselves against what our government has, because that, of course, is exactly the purpose of the Second Amendment. To keep ourselves free from tyrants is ultimately the problem. That's always been the problem, you know, especially for an armed nation. An armed nation doesn't really have to worry about the enemy next door. They have to worry about the enemy right there, right in their camp. And it's always the tyrant. trying to take the gun away. So, anyway. Okay, let me unmute you. Looks like someone has already unmuted him. Can you talk, Ari? All right, let me try unmute you.
Okay.
All right, you can talk now.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that. From what I understand, that really basically sets in stone our rights, reinforces the Second Amendment, according to the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It reinforces the Second Amendment, according to the Supreme Court, the Dick Act.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I would agree with that. You could use it up to back up the Second Amendment. I wouldn't argue that point. Again, I haven't read through it thoroughly to know if there's some kind of trap in there. Sometimes the trap is really in the language. But again, that's all changing the meaning of words anyway, so I wouldn't worry about that. It just gets back to fiction. So, but yeah, I use codes and I use different things that, the legislative acts say, which use them all the time. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you all's time tonight. Keep on fighting. Thank you.
Okay.
Hey.
Thank you. Let's take our next caller. Let's see. It's Gene from Florida, I think. It's anonymous. Someone I just unmuted, they have Gene from Florida, but that may not be the correct name. It's an anonymous caller. Okay, next person, Michael from Colorado.
Oh, hi, John. How are
you doing?
Good. I forward default to Jim and Kelly, and you... Received it by fax, am I correct?
Yeah, I think I got it today. I'll try to get through all this paperwork done this week. I've got a couple of them, I think, back today. So I think two, maybe three. So.
Okay. Another thing, do you have a Cindy's number or Crystal's number from Connecticut?
Whose number? Crystal?
Yes.
Crystal, do you want to give out your number? Let me see if I can find Crystal and unmute her. Crystal, get into the hit star 6, Crystal. Star 6, Crystal.
I just
Crystal
unmuted
from Connecticut,
her.
Right? Oh, yeah. Crystal, do you? I don't know if you want to give out your number to Michael
or
from Colorado.
Have her call me. Have her call me.
Michael, go ahead. Give Crystal your phone number.
Hi, Crystal. My name's Michael Giron, Jiron. My number is 719-580-6194. Give me a call. I'd like to speak to you about my probate case.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, did you get that number, Crystal? He wants to talk to you about some of this. Try it again and read it slowly. He wants to talk to you, I guess, about some of the stuff you've been talking about. So, but go ahead, read your number to him again, her again, Michael.
719-580-6194.
So that was 791-580-6194.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
That's it. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Crystal. Okay. Let's take our next person, Tracy. It looks like 619 area code. What state you from?
California.
Tracy from California. Go right ahead.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thank you. I have a question. It's my understanding that the land is patented. Certain land in America is patented, and if your family has that patented land, that land has use rights. So my problem involves an estate, and I had a straw man created about 8 days after the grantor died, and the attorney put the wealth of my inheritance, my 15% of this land and the land use rights, as well as everything else but $100,000 into that straw man trust. I objected to people trying to cut in and be trustee, and when I did, was targeted very badly. 3 years passed. It's been another 12 or 13 since then, but the principal, which was my stolen asset, is what has been being used, and you're entitled to distributions once it's in a trust. To me, the first crime was an attorney putting it into trust. He was not my attorney. It was less than 10 days after the grantor died. I hadn't even had time to get an attorney. His intent was to steal it, and I think it's
pretty
common that this is done all the time. This is
yeah, him and that attorney and the judge has things going on. When they see these kind of cases come up, they try to seize on them very quickly, and the judge tries to give fiduciary authority to some attorney as quick as possible so that he can start making decisions and they can start reaping the funds as much as they can get out of the system. They're nothing but a bunch of criminals. And it's happening every day, all over, everywhere. It's unbelievable on how they do these things. But look at, you can defeat and argue these, but again, you have to know how to get into the courts. If people want to get into, it's time to get educated, people. Even if, you know, people want to get into the courts now, they got problems, but they haven't become educated. And for those who don't have any court problems right now, you better get educated so that you can deal with your problems. Of course, when we get onto the other side, you know, other side meaning being we accomplish our goal by taking the judiciary back. When we get to the other side, we won't have these problems. But it is true, you can challenge them on two things. They don't have a proof of claim and they don't have fiduciary authority. There are two forms that they must fill out on the federal level in order to get this and file it in the federal courts in the jurisdiction, you know, within the district court in that area. And that would be, it's called the number Form 56 and a Form 4490. Form 56 and 4490. And one gives fiduciary authority, the other one gets proof of claim, and they have to do a sworn affidavit on it. It is a sworn affidavit form. They'll never do it. And if that doesn't exist, then they'd never own it. They don't own it. And you know, like, who gave them fiduciary authority over me or my estate? That's the question.
Well, they got it first, and secondly, I was targeted, and men got in there co-trusteeing it. And what's going on now is I need to go habeas corpus because I understand the way that they got it 18 years ago was what was called a silent conviction. And what they do is they move to target you according to the trust language, incapacitate, incompetent, bankrupt, and you'll get targeted.
How is it that you want to do the habeas corpus? You want to do the habeas corpus to take your body out of the court, or what is it you're looking to do?
Yeah, I suspect that they have me in courts and their mental health in it. And I think And so I almost feel like I need APS protection or I don't know what that is. But
are you seized by a court right now?
I think that I am by surveillance, and they're not notifying me.
Well,
and
that's a whole different story. No. It sounds because you said you were 12 years out from this case to begin with, right?
But it came up for reevaluation in the last year, and.
Okay, so they're concerned. All right, yeah. You know, first of all, you can't do a habeas corpus to be brought out of a court that you don't even know you're in or not. You have to know that you're in it, and I don't see any way that you can be in it.
Well, and that's, you know, a kangaroo court when they're doing a mental health evaluation on you, or they just hold open an
investigation. Are they doing a mental? Then is there a court order to do a mental health evaluation on you?
Well, that's my point, is that they're not telling me if there is. And I was just recently involved in a workman's comp for a broken wrist, and I caught the releases. I felt very uncomfortable with the attorneys. We looked at one of the releases I signed in good faith, and it says, quote, unquote, instead of establish a wrist disability, it says we're hired to establish a disability. So I almost think that they have been working to try to establish.
Well, look, if you're in the administrative courts, which is where you're at, you're only going to get pennies. You know, for any injury that you've gotten, you need to take it into a. And you, if you really have something that's serious, you could take it into a court of law, and bypass the administrative stuff. They'll try to tell you can't, but me, I ignore them. And I've ignored them numerous times and never even came out trying to make the argument against me. I still moved over to other courts and they've never been able to defeat that.
And so what I thought was corpus in federal court?
Well,
I mean,
again, I don't know enough about your case. Look, here's the thing. You can rest assured there are two violations upon you. One is due process. That's obvious. It's clear. They never gave you due process. They took your property. And the other thing is they've taken you into jurisdictions unknown. You're in a foreign jurisdiction. You have no clue in what jurisdiction you're really in, and they don't say so up on the top of the paperwork. But you rest assured you're in an administrative court, no matter how you put it. It's a statutory court, and you need to get out of that.
Yeah, and it could be anywhere in California, so I don't know where to file. It's the same problem that I've had all those other years.
Yeah, but it's more than that. Look, at the best battle, you've been in this a long time, and you're 12-plus years into it. The best battle to get back what was unlawfully taken from you is to work with the people to bring us back onto bring us back under the common law. Take back the judiciary, which they rightly own. It's our judiciary. We, the people, we have to either consent or not to whatever cases they have going up there, criminally speaking, or anything that they want to take your property or see. When the government wants to seize your property, wait a second here, So we the people need to consent to these things, and we do that through the juries, and we need to control the juries to make sure that the juries are free juries, untainted, uncontrolled, okay? Now, when I said control the juries, I mean control the process of the juries as far as them bringing them through orientation and setting them free, the power of being able to make the decisions and the final decisions, this is what we have to do. We're not too far away from that, I don't think. But it's going to take the people, it's going to take critical mass, which we're setting forth. But we've come to the end of our program here. So I appreciate your call. And we'll be back next Monday, Lord willing, and we'll pick things up again. We'll bring back some new news. Hopefully we'll have some exciting stuff. There's a lot of exciting stuff going on, a lot of it. And, we'll be bringing them up soon. Also, don't forget Thursday nights to organize. We meet at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here for organizing across the nation, the Committees of Safety. And also those people interested in ham operating, and everybody should be somewhat interested, but especially those who are interested in becoming ham operators or considering whether they want to be a ham operator or not. We have the Wednesday call at 8 p.m. Just click on our weekly call button on the top left side of our website, and you can read our schedule of all the things we've got going on. And people should be joining other committees that we have going here in National Liberty Alliance. Only the people working together can save America. So that's what we need to do. Okay, with that, God bless everyone, and see you next time. Thank you.
Amazing grace, how sweet the